All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, I admonish to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 0682 Sandy L.
May it please the court, Michael Carvin for appellants. I will be, as was just indicated, dealing with the liabilities issues other than lights, and I've been allotted 25 minutes. I'd like to begin with what I...
You're a little hard to hear. I don't know if the fault of Brutus is in our stars or ourselves, but do the best you can to...
Is this any better, Your Honor? Well, I'll increase my volume. How's that sound? I want to begin with what I think is the first fatal threshold flaw in the liability, which is that the district court applied a theory of specific intent under the fraud statutes, which is plainly erroneous. She used a collective corporate intent model, which even the government now concedes on appeal is completely contrary to this court's decision in Saba and otherwise contrary to law. In a complete reversal of the argument they made below, the government now admits that you need to analyze specific intent in terms of the individual corporate spokesperson. You need to analyze whether or not he or she said something that was contrary to what he or she knew or believed, not whether it was contrary to the collective corporate knowledge of the entire corporation or the enterprise as a whole. Recognizing that their entire case was therefore tried on a theory that's contrary to this court's decision in Saba, the government, with incredible chutzpah, now comes to this court and pretends that Judge Kessler agreed with us, and she agreed that specific intent cannot be established by looking at the collective knowledge of the corporations or the enterprise as a whole. But that's completely contrary to her opinion, including the very title of this section of opinion at A3310, which says specific intent may be established by the collective knowledge of each defendant and of the enterprise as a whole. She goes on and repeats that erroneous formulation at least six times, including in the sentence following her discussion of what she referred to as the Delphic footnote in Saba, where she in terms, quote, rejects the theory of specific intent which defendants advocate, i.e., requiring that a corporate state of mind can only be established by looking at each individual corporation at the time he or she acted. In other words, she rejects...
I see your point. I mean, the district court did recite in several places the wrong standard, but elsewhere she seems to have gotten it right. For example, she says the findings of fact are replete with examples of representatives of each defendant of CTR and of the Tobacco Institute either willfully stating something which they knew to be untrue or recklessly disregarding the facts. And then she lists many individuals, and the record is full of these examples of corporate officials making statements that, based on the knowledge of the evidence existing in the company, they should have known were false, and that's what she attributed to the corporation. Not accurate?
No, it's inaccurate, Your Honor, respectfully, for two reasons. Yeah. Number one, she never made any credibility findings about whether our corporate spokespersons or CEOs knew something that they didn't believe, because
couldn't she do that on the basis of circumstantial evidence?
Absolutely, if she had ever looked at it. But she never looked at it because the issue was never joined. The issue was never joined because from the beginning of this case, at its opening statement and in its pretrial statements, the government said they weren't going to...
Well, look, let me just give you an example. Finding 736.
Mm-hmm.
This is a 1971 Face the Nation interview.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, it's true that babies born from women who smoke are small, but they are just as healthy as babies born to women who do not smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Some women would prefer to have small babies.
Right.
And the district court found that that was directly contradicted by information that the vice president for research gave the CEO 2 years earlier.
And I'm saying if she had done that kind of connect the dots on the fraud that was alleged here, there was no fraud arguing that we were lying about the effects of mothers, pregnant mothers on their babies. There was arguments that we were lying about the effects of secondhand smoke. There is no kind of connect the dots there, because in this part of the opinion where they claim she had made this credibility determination, which is at page 3236 of the opinion, first of all, is not even in the part of opinion discussing specific intent. But more important, she finds that these statements were untrue because they were making statements which were inconsistent with the internal knowledge and practice of the corporation itself, yes, not of the internal knowledge and practice that they knew about.
But aren't those related? I mean, isn't she saying that because they are high officials of the corporation, they would know about the research that was inconsistent with the statements? In other words, she isn't saying this is corporate knowledge. She's saying it's knowledge they directly have because they are senior officials, and this is the research product of the corporation.
No? Your Honor. She says precisely the opposite at least four times. At page 3313 of the joint appendix, she says, a corporation should be held liable when the totality of circumstances demonstrate that such a corporation collectively knew what it was doing or saying was false, even if it is impossible to determine the state of mind of the individual agent or officer at the time. She goes on to explain why that would be a horrible burden to impose on plaintiffs. Again, this is also from 3313 of the joint appendix. Okay. She said that would create an insurmountable burden for plaintiff in a corporate mail fraud wire cases and frustrate the purposes of the statute. She goes on to explain again. Same page. Indeed, if it were otherwise, defendants could avoid liability by simply dividing up duties to ensure that fraudulent statements were only made by uninformed employees. She obviously did not apply a standard that she thought would create an insurmountable burden for plaintiffs, frustrate the purpose of the statute, and allow a huge loophole where guilty corporations could be found liable. In the very page following what you had referred to about her absurd to believe statement, on 3237, she says, when a spokesperson of a large sophisticated corporation makes statements of what defendants now characterize as opinion, but which can be proved false by information that was available and known to the corporation at the time, the company cannot be permitted to escape liability merely because it declined to inform that individual spokesman that his or her statement was misleading.
I guess I don't understand why. I get your point about her statements about collective knowledge. And those are not accurate. But that statement could easily be read as the district court saying, because they are senior officials, they would have known about the research that the corporation undertook, which she calls corporate research, which is what it is.
That's fine.
And you wouldn't have a problem with that, right? So,
if it was true.
So what in fact is the problem that there isn't a sentence which says, I find that statement, well, let's just take an example here. Okay. Finding 777. This is the RJR chair on Nightline.
Mm-hmm.
He says, it is not known whether cigarettes cause cancer. As a matter of fact, there are studies conducted over years that would say that science is still uncertain about this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right. What she did not do was...
So now, I take it what you think is missing there is a next statement which says RJR had internal research that this CEO knew about and that therefore the statement is fraudulent.
Not only is that missing, she disavows the need to connect the dots up that way. I want to make 3 points. Number one, I think it's probable or certainly possible that they could have cobbled together some kind of specific individual intent on the notion that the denials for smoking causes disease were indeed contrary to what the CEOs knew. But they didn't try and make that argument because they knew they couldn't make the case with respect to ETS, addiction, lights, or any of the other frauds that actually matter in 2008. because there's not one example in that 1,700-page opinion, for example, where anybody in the entire enterprise over 50 years said that we do think it's established that ETS causes disease. And so they knew that if they tried to make the argument on causation, that they couldn't do it. So what did they do, for example, with addiction? What is their example on addiction? It's that the Tobacco Institute knew that smoking was addictive. Why? Because they had some corporate CEOs on the Tobacco Institute board who knew it. Why? Not because they had ever seen it or agreed with it, but because some unnamed employees at the corporations presumably believed it. So she is imputing to the Tobacco Institute the knowledge of corporate employees with whom they've never come in contact. That is absolutely, in a criminal statute, impermissible.
I read it as her saying the senior corporate leaders who were on the board of the Tobacco Institute knew of the research that their own companies had done.
Mm-hmm. And there was no research. She found that the research in 1988 that the tobacco industry had paid sparse attention to the question of addiction. There was no research that said smoking is addictive.
No,
there couldn't have been.
Not the Tobacco Institute, the companies.
The companies, precisely my point.
But the senior officials of the companies were on the Tobacco Institute board.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. Now, why did the corporate CEOs know that smoking was addictive?
Because their company had done research on it.
Because the corporation agreed that it had unpleasant withdrawal sensations. But nobody thought, including the Surgeon General until 1988, thought that smoking was addictive. And this is a perfect illustration of what I've been talking about. It's not even facts we're dealing with. It's semantic labels. So she is putting into the minds of these people views about semantic labels like addiction that they didn't agree with, and they were quite clear on the basis for their disagreement, which was that it does create unpleasant withdrawal sensations, but we don't view that as addictive in the same sense as heroin or cocaine. So you're turning the semantic debate, a disagreement with the Surgeon General, into some kind of finding of fact. She doesn't give one example of the thousands of corporate spokespersons who ever said something that she says they didn't know or didn't believe. In the contrary, she gives every example she gives of specific intent, which is taken directly from their post-trial brief, is this collective intent theory. And again, the reason that that's the only example she can give is because the issue was never joined at trial. In their pre-trial brief, the government made it as clear as possible that they weren't going to try and prove it up. In addition to the opening statement, we quote at page 24 of our brief, they say, among a million different examples, when the CEOs of defendants testified in 1994 before a congressional subcommittee and denied that nicotine was addictive and that the companies manipulated the amount of nicotine contained in the cigarettes, it is immaterial whether each of these CEOs were personally aware of the extensive information in their company's files that their public statements were counterfactual. So what you have here is a theory of fraud under a statute with criminal applications that says because some statement is lurking in the corporate files, which the CEOs are either unaware of or in good faith disagree with, we are nonetheless going to hold them liable for specific intent. Well, if that was true, they could have indicted them for perjury.
Are you arguing that specific intent cannot be imputed here because this is a criminal statute, or are you arguing that the government didn't make the case?
I am arguing three things, Judge Brown. Number one, it can't be imputed under the civil fraud or criminal fraud because, as we know from Leah Cal versus Ashcroft and Yellow Bus, if a statute has criminal applications, and this is purely a criminal fraud statute, the rule of lenity applies. And you need to show a specific intent by the individual who would actually be going to jail. I am arguing, number two, that the government said from the outset of this case, we are not going to try and prove that Mr. Jones or Mr. Brown, who ran these corporations, said or believed anything that was contrary to what they said or believed publicly. We are going to impute to them the knowledge of corporate employees over whom they have no control and or never came in contact with. And yes, that under Saba, that is an absolute distortion of the basic precepts of the specific intent statute.
I can understand how Saba would support your argument that collective intent is inappropriate here. But how does it support your argument that you can't impute specific intent?
Because that was exactly what was at issue in Saba. In other words, the only difference between collective and imputing is I have employee A and employee B. Employee A doesn't think smoking is addictive. Employee B does. You impute employee B's beliefs to employee A, so when employee A says it's not addictive, you say it's a knowing falsehood. Well, it's not a knowing falsehood. He disagrees with employee B, or he never knew what employee B thought about addiction. So how can you make that person a liar when he's saying exactly what he believes in good faith? The Supreme Court couldn't have been clear on this when knowledge was at issue in the New York Times v. Sullivan case. It says you can't look at what's lurking in the files of the corporation as a whole to establish malice. You have to look at what the reporter thought or the editor thought, the people who are responsible for the speech. And there is not one case anywhere where anyone has ever gone to jail under the fraud statutes because they said something they believed because it was contrary to what the corporation believed. And the government tried its entire case on that theory, and now they're seeking to pretend that Judge Kessler didn't follow their lead in that analysis.
How far this theory goes, if, and I'm not asking you to concede that this is the case, but if it's the case that the corporate records disclose a pattern of having research done that produces evidence that smoking is in fact addictive, that evidence is sufficiently compelling that there are internal memoranda, not involving the CEO directly, but internal memoranda that say, well, I guess it's addictive. And then the CEO later says it's not addictive. Mm-hmm. You say that it would then be impossible to find from that kind of circumstantial evidence that the CEO had the necessary knowledge at the time he made the expression?
I think that that kind of analysis is done typically in fraud cases. All you have to do is connect the dots. And that's my entire point. They didn't connect the dots because there was...
What you say is lacking here when we're reviewing the district court's decision on that point? What is it you say is lacking here in the connection of the dots?
That she imputed or assumed that the corporate CEOs agreed with knowledge lurking somewhere in their corporation or indeed at another corporation in the enterprise as a whole. What she needed to do was find it. And what she didn't do was find it because they didn't try and prove it. All I'm asking is that you do exactly what they do in fraud cases every single day. Say this was his part of his job responsibilities. He knew about this research and he didn't do it. Now, what if they had tried to show that with respect to ETS? The government spends four pages in its brief trying to prove up that this outfit called Inbifo in Germany was saying things that were contrary to what Philip Morris was saying in Richmond about secondhand smoke. And what's their example?
ETS, the government's case, is not nearly as strong as it is on this.
Well, Your Honor, I must respectfully disagree. What is the issue?
Do you think the addiction case is weak? You think the ETS case is as strong as the addiction case?
I think, who is better, Willie Mays or Hank Aaron? They're both incredibly strong cases because addiction is, I would argue, the silliest and most dangerous aspect of the government's case. It's not a disagreement about fact. It's a disagreement about whether you label a habit that is obviously difficult to quit, addiction or dependence. The Surgeon General didn't think that it should be called addiction until he completely changed his definition in 1988. The World Health Organization and the American Psychiatric Association to this day have a different definition of addiction than does the Surgeon General. She found that there's not even a consensus in the public health authorities about whether this is called addiction or dependence. I can't think of a word that is more of a semantic minefield and has less of a fixed meaning. And if the tobacco companies had misled anybody about this semantic debate, maybe they'd have an argument. But they were as clear as a bell. If you stop smoking, it makes you irritable, restless, and sleepless. Precisely the definition that she claims was their internal understanding, and precisely the definition that the public health authorities put forward. So we're not disagreeing about what happens when you quit smoking. We're disagreeing about what label you attach to that. And if you can engage in that kind of semantic minefield and hold people in jail, then I think you've done a tremendous disservice to the due process rights of these people.
Why is it engaging in semantics?
Sorry.
Why is it engaging... Why is it semantics when statements say when the CEOs say that, it's addictive, but it's addictive like gummy bears?
You know, they establish a cathedral around this gummy bear statement as if we were out advocating to the American public it was as addictive as gummy bears. What they don't tell you is that that statement was made in a deposition, which was not communicated to the public at the end of a deposition, where a CEO undoubtedly annoyed said, look, There are certain things that are addictive, like heroin and cocaine, where you have a severe physical dependence. And there's other things which don't create that kind of danger. Now, if you're going to take a statement at a deposition, which was never communicated to the public, and call it consumer fraud, that is an example of the kind of stretching the facts that she does. The Surgeon General says alcohol is an addicting drug. Is Bacardi rum committing fraud if they say, you know, we're not addictive like heroin and cocaine. We know what the Surgeon General thinks.
I don't know. Maybe they would be.
Maybe they would be. But do you really want to put people in jail because they don't like the politically correct terminology that the Surgeon General wakes up once morning and decides he's going to impose on the American public, particularly when it's not a word of fixed meaning? He found that all tobacco products, smokeless tobacco, cigars are addictive. Can the cigar company say, you know, we're a little different than heroin? Can the smokeless tobacco people say, we're not addictive in the sense that was traditionally understood? They can't make their argument in a public policy debate where regulation is hanging over their head that we really don't think the most pejorative possible label you can attach to our product is appropriate. Not only does that distort the fraud statutes beyond all recognition, I would argue it goes to core protected First American speech, where ever since the Alien and Sedition Act, it's been quite clear you don't have to accept the government's view of the world, and this is a public policy debate that is intimately intertwined with the kinds of examples of regulation that is protected under Norr Pennington, and again, is core protected speech. And, Your Honors, I mean, if this really bothers anybody, let's just concede we were wrong. What conceivable difference does that make in 2008? We've agreed. Call it what you want. Addictive dependence withdrawal. We're not arguing about it anymore. Is it material to any smoker? Was there a shred of evidence that any smoker in the world used this in determining whether
why do you need evidence?
Because it's...
Isn't the only question whether that statement, if believed, would affect a reasonable person's decision?
I'm sorry. If there's no evidence that anybody believed it.
No, but I'm saying, why is that relevant?
I thought you conceded
that point in your reply brief, that the standard is whether, if believed, the statement would affect a reasonable person's decision to buy cigarettes.
But I think we're confusing two different issues. You've got to prove it was believed that and a reasonable person would believe it. You need evidence.
You do?
This is a court of law. Yes, it's an essential element of a materiality thing. It's like saying you don't have to prove specific intent. You don't have to prove materiality. Absolutely, it's a court of law. You need evidence. You can't go on what Judge Kessler's personal hunches were. In a statute that has criminal application, no. You need evidence to prove it. And you need to show that a reasonable person would attach significance to it. If you define materiality as whatever any unreasonable person might attach significance to,
let me read you what you say in your reply brief.
Sorry?
Let me just read what you say in your reply brief about this.
Mm-hmm.
The materiality, by contrast, turns on whether a statement, if believed, would be important to a reasonable consumer's purchasing decision.
Right. So let's talk about addiction.
No, wait. Well, let's stick with the standard.
I'm sorry.
That's your standard, which seems to me is correct. And there's no requirement in that standard that there be evidence that a reasonable person would or would not believe it.
But no.
The only question is whether, if believed.
Yes. And how do we know whether or not a reasonable person believed it or attached significance to it? The way you do that under Brown and Williamson is you show evidence. You do exactly what they did with respect to lights. You do public opinion surveys and say this is how people interpreted the lights descriptors. You don't have a scintilla of evidence along those lines with respect to addiction or ETS, because I submit that no rational person who knows that smoking is difficult to quit cares whether you label addiction, dependence, or withdrawal. And they've got the burden of proving, at least by a preponderance of evidence, that rational people do attach significance to this absurd semantic debate, particularly if it's going to be grounds for imposing prior restraints on corporate speech in the face of regulation. So whatever the standard is, it needs to be supported by evidence. And I totally agree with Your Honor that it is a reasonable person standard, not the unreasonable person standard that Judge Kessler imposed, which has no role in a consumer fraud case and only applies if you've targeted people that you knew to be unusually gullible and would believe whatever you told them. That's not an issue in this case. I'd also, if I might, like to use my remaining minute to make the point that her definition of enterprise is completely contrary to the language of the statute. I accept that Perholtz says you can expand the definition of enterprise beyond the statutory definition. What you can't use is a definition of enterprise which makes the statutory definition irrelevant because it overrides a specific statutory limitation. You can't have a definition of enterprise that says individuals who are not associated, in fact, constitute an enterprise. By the same token, you can't change the word individuals to corporations. All Perholtz said was the enterprise here, the defendants here are individuals. The enterprise is individuals. They're using the corporations as a vehicle for pushing their money around. We are not going to create a loophole in the statutory definition that Congress imposed, individuals associated in fact, by exempting it if a corporation was part of it.
Don't corporations only act through individuals?
Precisely. So
is it doing great violence to the congressional definition of inclusion to say that an association of corporations which are acting through individuals comes within the definitional section?
Perholtz itself said that, Your Honor. Perholtz itself said, under Yellow Bus, we are not reaching the question of corporations who have agents.
Your time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the next counsel. Good morning, Mr. Estrada.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Miguel Estrada. I'm counsel for Philip Morris USA, and I will speak on behalf of all defendants to the lights issue, the future violations issue, and the remedies issues. Let me start with the lights. The government's position in this case is that it is perfectly lawful for the defendants to tell a consumer that a pack of cigarettes has per cigarette 16 milligrams of tar, under the FTC method, and that another pack has 11 milligrams of tar, but that it is criminal fraud to tell the consumer that 11 is lower than 16. To call this position incomprehensible, as Justice Alito did in the argument last week, doesn't quite do it justice. It is now the case, and it has never been the case, that the use of descriptors is fraudulent or even false because they correctly characterize the outcomes of the FTC-authorized test since 1966. Now, the government's theory in the case, and which Judge Kessler accepted, is entirely this. This would not be fraud. This would not be false, but for compensation. Because of the fact that a consumer may puff more deeply or smoke more cigarettes, this has now become fraud.
Isn't her reason for that the companies knew that? In other words, when they say that it's a low tar cigarette, they knew based on their own research that in fact it wasn't because of compensatory smoking.
I did not hear the first part of the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this better? My question was, didn't the district court say that, you know, abstractly, the phrase low tar is not inaccurate, but that based on the company's own research about compensatory smoking, that they knew that in fact they weren't low tar because of the way smokers compensate?
See, but
that's her theory, right?
Yes, and that's exactly right. At finding, I believe, 2068, she explains that the way consumers compensate is by puffing more deeply on the one hand or smoking more cigarettes.
Right, and the companies knew that based on their own research.
Everybody knew it, Judge Stadel.
The point is in terms of whether it's fraudulent or not.
Well, but
companies knew it.
That, we can go to the record. I mean, on the one hand, just as a matter of law, it is unreasonable to say that a consumer could think that he would get the prescribed amount solely on the basis of smoking more units of the product. And the fact is, in 1966, And this is in the record. When the FTC was conducting hearings on this issue, the companies did tell the FTC that a smoker might be compelled to get his nicotine fix by smoking more. And that's Joint Exhibit 4748 right. at page 131. This was known in 1966. Now, on whether consumers would puff more deeply, the issue has been, so to speak, ventilated ad nauseum in this courthouse. The Brown and Williamson litigation came here in 1983. You may recall that the whole issue in the litigation was compensation. And both the FTC, Judge Gazelle, and this court were fully aware that compensation was going on and that there were two types of it. You could smoke more or or take deeper puffs. And the FTC, Judge Gazelle, and this court all said it is irrelevant because everybody has known from 1966 that the point of the system is to tell the consumer how much tar they would get compared to another cigarette if they smoke the two cigarettes in the same way. It was never from the get-go any sort of a claim by the agency, mind you, that any of these numbers had any bearing on the amount of tar or nicotine that a consumer would get.
I take your point about low tar. Your point there is that low tar reflects the actual numbers, right? Low tar identifies cigarettes that in fact have low tar, correct?
Uh-huh. Yes.
But what about the phrases like light? And I ask that because of the district court. The district court has this finding. She says, there are lights of certain brands with higher tar levels than regulars of other brands from the same company. And there are also lights and regulars of the same brand that have the same FTC tar rating. Now, so what she's saying there is that the labels light are being used inconsistently, that they don't always reflect low tar.
Well, I think they're...
You don't challenge that fact finding, do you?
We haven't challenged any fact fact finding.
So that's a fact finding.
All of our arguments are purely legal.
Uh-huh.
The key point about something like lights is that there is that no consumer gets the same message from hearing lights.
No, but in terms of, you were saying that the labels accurately describe.
But they do, and that's
level,
the point.
Let me just finish. You say the labels accurately describe the tar level in the cigarettes, but here you have a finding that that's not the case, that they are inaccurate.
Well, no. Whether they are accurate or inaccurate, I would think is a legal conclusion. But in fact, defining.
Well, let me go back. I thought you said they're just true. They're literally true.
That's your argument. They are true. They're literally
but,
true.
But here,
they're
here you have
true.
A finding. Here you have a finding that you haven't challenged, which suggests that's not the case.
Well, because what is going on with lights as opposed to low tar is that lights are a particular kind of low tar cigarettes, and what lights do accurately describe is that they have lower tar than the regular pack of the same brand, and also have also.
But actually,
the meaning
that's inconsistent with this finding.
I don't believe so, because I don't believe she was making any findings as between brands. But in any event, it also conveys a taste message. And of course, look, we have a large dispute in the district court on the question of whether the defendants intended a health message or a taste message. Our position is that we intended a taste message. Of course,
you said, say that again?
That we intended a taste message.
A taste message.
Of course. Given that the entire system of low tar descriptors was set up by the FTC for the purpose of encouraging the American public to smoke low tar cigarettes if they could not quit, it is incontestable that some consumers obviously got a health message. But that's not inconsistent with a label like lights to have a dual message, and some consumers would take away that it's a milder smoking experience than the I don't want to say harsher, say red pack,
more
but also
full flavored is the more
right.
full flavored is the
front. And I will point out, Judge Sintel, that in connection with that, when Judge Kessler herself was engaging in her conclusions of law, she herself used the contrast between the low tars and lights with full flavor.
Yeah.
Cigarettes.
I wasn't just referring to my own experience on that. I wasn't
But right. there's also, excuse me.
Do you have more?
No, about this subject? Yeah.
I was going to say that was past the end of the time on this subject.
Oh, can I, let me just, more questions? I just finished my question. I was going to ask him about the finding at 2591, which is a memo from one of the companies, I think it's Batco, which refers to light as a, quote, health reassurance label.
Right, and I think that's perfectly
health
consistent.
Health reassurance.
It is perfectly consistent with what I just said, Judge Tatel. I think the entire FTC system was set up to convey to the consumers that if these items were smoked in the same way, they would not be as unhealthy as the regular cigarettes. And from the get-go, the condition of that was that you could not make collateral health representations other than the fact that they are low tar.
Just one more question. I don't want to take you too much over your time, but you do argue that with respect to light and the other descriptors that the FTC has approved these, right?
We do.
Yeah. No.
But it's not.
Shouldn't we? Why should we decide that now? Shouldn't we just wait to see what the Supreme Court does?
Well, there are two issues. There are two issues in the Supreme Court. Judging from the argument, one would never know.
I wasn't there. So, but there, it is possible that they'll
it
have to address
possible.
This question.
It is possible. I think it's unlikely.
You mean because they'll do it on express preemption?
Because it's a secondary issue in the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is an
but
issue that
would... But if it's just possible, given the timing of the Supreme Court argument, why should we wrestle with that question when we may get clear direction from the court?
Because whether the FTC authorized or was indifferent to our use of the descriptors, they would still be an accurate representation of the system that the FTC undoubtedly still has today. And my last point on that, Judge Tatel, is if you keep in mind what the timeline in this case has been, Monograph 13 came out in 2001. Mm-hmm. It took the FTC until last month even to think about rejiggering the descriptor system. If it is indeed true that the government believes its theory of fraud, the most minimal regard for the public safety might have impelled them to think about it sooner, say 8 years ago. And that point leads me to my ending point on lights, which is that as one of the justices said, I think quite aptly last week, if there has been a fraud on lights, it was a fraud that was committed by the FTC. Okay. Let me turn.
Yes. You'll have 12 minutes on the likelihood of future violations, Mr. Sharp.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me start just by pointing out something that I think is sort of a big picture item on the future violations. When the government announced in 1999 that they were going to bring a RICO case against the tobacco industry, they had three choices under RICO. Number one, Section 1962, old-fashioned criminal case, jury trial, cumbersome procedural protections. You could never try in a criminal case the type of trial that was had in case in the district court in this case, and the government passed on the criminal. There was 1964C, payos cash. The government, I think, is not a proper plaintiff under 1964C, and they have some causation issues as well. So that left the government with a single choice, and the choice they took, which is 1964A. But as this court pointed out in the disgorgement case, the choice has consequences because this is a statute with very specific language. And the only way that the court would have jurisdiction in the case was if the government was seeking an injunction to prevent and restrain future RICO violations, future violations of Section 1962, not future mail fraud, not future unethical conduct, future criminal RICO violations. The government did not undertake its burden in this case. I don't think it didn't even try. It is impossible, as a result of the MSA for the government to demonstrate that there is a likely future enterprise or likely future fraud. Under the provisions of the MSA, which are in the joint appendix beginning at A7158, the companies are enjoined from any joint activity in the future that could replicate the enterprise.
But didn't the district court decide? I see your point about the burden of proof, by the way. But didn't the district court, right before she discusses the MSA, she makes specific findings that the defendants are continuing to commit RICO violations. They continue to deny that secondhand smoke is a health hazard, the cigarettes are physiologically addictive, that they manipulate a nicotine. She has a specific finding on that, and
right.
There's no burden of proof problem there.
Well,
she got
that
one.
There are two answers to that. Number one is that what she labels a continuing RICO violation is not so because she did not identify any current enterprise. She did not identify any current enterprise. So in the very best, she could say that...
Wait, is that the same as the Perholtz argument?
No.
No.
All I'm saying is after the MSA, where the CTR and the Tobacco Institute and all of the instrumentalities of the enterprise, all of the means for the defendants to get together to conduct
need formal organizations to have an enterprise. The enterprise could be continued informally, even without those organizations, couldn't it?
It is possible for an enterprise to exist.
It's clear under the statute you don't need formal corporate structure.
Judge Tettle, I think we're saying two different things.
Okay.
She did not find that there is currently any cooperation among the defendants to engage in any of the conduct which, if done under an enterprise, would be RICO. She found some things that she believed to be fraudulent, completely unconnected to the required enterprise, because there is a none.
There, counsel, and it's a rather short one, I hope. When you say that the remedy under 1964A is to prevent and restrain violation of Section 1962, would that not empower the court to impose remedies that would restrain the various segments or elements of a RICO enterprise as opposed to just restraining the totality?
Well, this court already said in the previous opinion that the most suitable remedy would be to separate the person from the enterprise. That's the intended remedy. And of course, yes, but it is a predicate for the imposition of that remedy.
Would it not be possible or lawful or admissible for a court under 1964A to enjoin the commission of predicate acts in order to accomplish the task of restraining and deterring further violations, as opposed to just enjoining commission of RICO violations?
Possibly, but as a predicate for that more limited injunction, Judge Santel, there would have to be evidence from which the court could conclude that there is a likely future RICO violation. And if that cannot occur because the enterprise is defunct and cannot be brought back, or there's already
an... Where is this likelihood requirement drawn from?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Where is the likelihood requirement drawn from?
Well, it is both from equity principles and from the language of 1964A. It is...
The language of 1964A, does that include that likelihood requirement?
Well, it says...
Prevent and restrain
violations of Section 1962.
Yeah.
This court's cases under the SEC statutes, and ultimately, you know, the language of 1964A is not something that we need to win because it remains the case that it has always been a condition for the entry of an injunction that they be a likely future violation, and that's what this court, I think, said in the Savoy case and in the First City case, and in all of those cases. Now, the government says, look, all of those cases also recognize that it is lawful and possible in an appropriate case for a court to make that finding on the basis of the past, just recently adjudicated violations. But that does a that is a misreading of this court's cases, because what this court says is that it has to be based on the totality of the circumstances. And ignoring
what circumstance, I'm sorry.
Excuse me, sir.
I didn't understand what your adjective before.
It has to be based on the totality of the circumstances. And whether already there is an extant injunction, and there has not been even an effort to demonstrate that the injunctions that are already disarticulating the enterprise and that make it impossible for the enterprise to come back are not being enforced or don't cover the conduct.
Is there a time limitation on that extant injunctive relief?
No, there is not. The two injunctions that are most relevant here, which are the injunction H in the consent decree and injunction I, H basically says that the defendants cannot act jointly to suppress tobacco data, and I says that you cannot engage in any fraud in connection with tobacco products. Both of those go in perpetuity. And let me say that Judge Kessler never even asked the correct legal question, because she was persuaded by the government that the burden should be on the defendants, not merely to demonstrate what is obvious from the MSA, but to show that as a result of the MSA, wrongful conduct, not even a RICO violation, wrongful conduct was certain not to recur. And that, I think, conceitedly, is a wrong legal standard. Now, I will hasten to say, Judge Kessler did take some potshots at the MSA, and none of them, and this is the more signal characteristic, have anything to do with RICO. You can look at the pages, and if anything, they show that the MSA is very actively enforced by the states, because what she had to offer was, A, you know, the government never pointed to a fraud that came to light and was not addressed by a state. The government pointed to things like there were billboards or you were using this sort of models, or you were sending ads to a magazine that may have an unduly large youth readership, and it's a handful of examples. None of those things have anything to do with RICO or even mail fraud. And so to the extent she believed that the MSA has not been effective, all of her examples were completely irrelevant to the main point of the exercise, which is a likelihood of future RICO violations. As I said, they do show that the states take very seriously the task of enforcing the MSA. She did express the fear, and I have to call it a fear, the speculative fear that this might not continue in the future. There is no evidence for that, and none was cited. Under the MSA, which again is in the appendix, the states get $50 million just to get started on enforcement. If they bring an enforcement action and they win under the MSA, again, they get costs and legal fees. And under the MSA, again, the states will be getting $6 to $7 billion, and I'd say billion with a B, dollars, for as long as probably everybody here will live. And so, you know, the notion that the states are not willing or able or lack the resources to enforce the MSA is worse than speculation, is speculation completely contrary to all of the available evidence. Now, let me say a word on the question of the remedies.
You've got 12 minutes on remedies separately.
Well, in that event, let me just highlight one point that I cut out for space, but I think it does exemplify how trivial the district court's objections to the MSA truly are. And this is in factual finding 4064. There is an assertion that the attorneys general have contacted Philip Morris on 40 occasions to raise a number of issues. And that assertion is literally true, because under the MSA, if a third party is using our marks, we are required upon notice to take commercially reasonable steps. This is in Article 3, to make sure that the old Wawa store that still has the Marlboro Man takes it down. And that is what lies at the essence of, say, for example, finding 4064. And the fact that the government has to stretch so far to find something so trivial that has so little to do with fraud of any sort and certainly so little to do with RICO, I think is a fair representation of the weakness of their case on the future violations issue. Now I think I have my time to go to the remedies.
Now to 12 minutes on remedies.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start first with the vagueness of the injunction. The defendants were enjoined, number one, from committing any act of racketeering as defined in Section 1961.1. Number two, making or causing to be made in any way any material, false, misleading, or deceptive statement. And number three, engaging in any public relations or marketing that misrepresents or suppresses information concerning cigarettes. So if we have marketing that, quote, suppresses information concerning cigarettes, we're enjoined from doing that. And there is no way for anyone to figure out what information it is that might possibly or not appropriately be suppressed from our marketing. Now, I think it really would be too kind to describe this as an obey the law injunction, though it is that. It doesn't comply with the requirements of Rule 65. And it really does what this court said in the Savoy case. It's impermissible for an injunction, which is it places the entire conduct of the defendant's business at the peril of a summons for contempt. And this court did not make that up in the Savoy case. It goes back to Justice Holmes' opinion in the Swift case in 1905, where Justice Holmes said that to place the entire conduct of the defendant's business at the peril of a summons for contempt was inequitable under the first principles of justice, and yet that is what this injunction does. Now, the government has one and only one answer to that, which is the McComb case in 1949. And they say that, you know, the McComb case stands for the proposition that an injunction cast in the statutory language may be appropriate to keep the defendants from evasions. And indeed, that's what the McComb case says. However, that argument was also in front of this court in the Savoy case. And what this court said was, all right, McComb shows that it is not impermissible to have an injunction that tracks a statute, but there are statutes and statutes. And as this court put it in the Savoy case, courts would not uphold an injunction that tracks the language of a broad and amorphous statute such as the Sherman Act, you know, the antitrust laws, were the example that this court gave in the Savoy case. And I think it would be hard to find a statute that is more open-ended and amorphous than the RICO statute. Now, there are a couple of other things about the McComb case, which is that the actual injunction in the case was actually not all that vague or that broad. It told the defendants to pay 40 cents in wages an hour, to pay time and a half for overtime, and to keep payroll records. That was the vague injunction in the McComb case. The alleged vageness, if you look at page 194 of that opinion, was that the injunction had failed to name the employees by name and did not do the math on a weekly and monthly basis. And it was that failing that the court said was irrelevant because it was inconsistent with the payroll realities of the day. Now, I can see where the Supreme Court would say that when you're being told, you know, the rate and time and a half and keep, you know, the names in the payroll. But I don't really see why the government would think that that has anything to do with this case. For good measure, you know, the court in the McComb case also made quite a big deal of the fact that the defendants, while the injunction was first entered, had not bothered to take an appeal or to seek any further guidance from the district court, and had only thought of raising the vagueness of the injunction when the government sought a citation for contempt. And, of course, that is not true here as well. Let me say...
Mr. Estrada, before you go into that, can I just... I want to ask you a question about a different argument that I thought you had made as a remedial argument, which I thought was interesting. You say that the district court failed to identify which alleged racketeering acts formed the pattern of racketeering activity, and that as a result, you can't tell whether the remedy is tailored to the violation. Now, is that something that you're arguing, or is that something I should ask Mr. Carvin
about? No, it's something that I'm happy to
address.
It's
a remedial issue, right?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
It's a remedial question.
Yes, it is. And it is right. I mean, obviously we concede that the district court wrote the history of tobacco in this country in 1,700 pages. That's quite different from doing anything with respect to the specific acts of racketeering that the government placed in front of the court, other than to say that I believe 4 out of 168 were covered by North Pennington.
I just have two questions about it. I mean, I thought your argument was interesting, and the court did find a scheme to defraud, right? It did find the existence of a scheme to defraud, and then it found that defendants had made a series of specific mailings and wire transmissions. They're at 3287 at SEC.
Uh-huh.
And that all of these mailings were in furtherance of the scheme. So what more do you need? What more do we need to know that the
that we need to know that the
list that she has the specific set of mailings at 3287, that those are the ones?
Well,
I mean, isn't that pretty obvious?
Not to me. If you look at what she said in connection with her findings of fraud, was on the one hand, on one page, I believe she says, the government has proffered these pillars of fraud. Footnote, I don't find that all that useful, all that relevant. Turn the page.
Well, I wasn't asking you about the footnote.
Well, but I think it's important to identify what findings were specifically made with respect to the allegations that are tied to the schemes, Judge Tatel, because I think under any view of the facts, given that 1964A only authorizes a jurisdiction to prevent and restrain future violations, and given that this court in the First City and other cases have said that those are generally only like violations, that is to say, those of a similar type or nature as those that have been engaged in, it is crucial to the jurisdiction of the court that she identified not 50 years of distasteful conduct, in her view, but a pattern that is tied up to the allegations of wrongdoing in a way that it can inform the judgment whether this type of wrongdoing is likely to recur.
And that the remedy is tailored, right?
The remedy is tailored.
Right.
But, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't.
And that the remedy is tailored.
Correct.
That's your argument. But I'm curious about what you mean by the remedy is tailored. Look, we know from the record that there's at least two predicate acts with respect to each company. We know that. And the record is full of findings on each of these other issues, or at least evidence on each of these other issues, secondary smoke, light cigarettes, addiction, and all these things. So, and the court found that all of those mailings, all of the mailings were in furtherance of the scheme. So don't we know all we need to know that to determine whether the remedy is properly tailored here? It is tailored to the scheme that the district court found, namely a scheme to defraud smokers.
Except
what's
that,
missing?
No, that's not sufficient. I mean, if I were arguing...
Well, what's missing?
Well, there are no findings that are tied to whether the particular fraud actually occurred, whether it was part of the pattern, and how it related to the enterprise. Let me give you an example
her findings are that all of these mailings and announcements were in furtherance of the scheme, and she found the scheme, namely a scheme to defraud smokers. And so it's not, and since there are at least two RICO acts with respect to each corporation, we have enough for liability, and it's not hard to see that it's tailored to the violation she found.
I don't think that we are contending that she did not purport to find a violation at the level of generality at which you stated it, Judge Tatel.
Right.
Our disagreement with it is whether the subsidiary findings that support what in essence is a conclusion are adequate for the remedy that she imposed.
Well, give me an example of what's missing.
Well, let me give you an example that I think maybe will clarify, maybe will not clarify. Mm-hmm. If this were a criminal case involving drugs, it would be enough for a conviction to find that a controlled substance was in the possession of the defendant. And you would say, well, now you have all you need to actually sentence the defendant. As a matter of fact, there are some controlled substances, like heroin, that call for a very stiff sentence, and some controlled substances, like marijuana, that do not. And in framing an injunction that addresses the likelihood that our misconduct in the past will recur, it is highly relevant to examine not whether she concluded that generally there had been a misconduct, but that the nature and quality of it be tied to the racketeering acts that were alleged by the government. And this was not all that difficult if she had been inclined to actually find it, but I don't think she actually was, because I don't think ultimately all of the fraud allegations that the government made, as Mr. Carvin pointed out, can plausibly be woven into a RICO violation that can be projected into the future. To give you one example, if she found that there was a pattern of racketeering that started in 1953 that had to do with people saying smoking is not addictive, but it's over. That would have no genetic...
I'm sorry, what's over?
If
is over.
If a fraud and a pattern as to addiction are over, and we're talking about historical conduct that the defendants have
But she found that it's reasonably likely to continue.
Well, but what is reasonably likely to continue is the important point, Judge Tatel. You cannot say that just because
there are mailings in the record that she found in furtherance of the scheme that relate to the denial of the addictiveness of smoking.
Again, but there is a disconnect between the necessary findings as to what the government found the pillars of fraud and an analysis as to how they relate to the remedy, because it is one thing to say that you companies once engaged in a fraud in denying addiction, and another one to say that justifies an injunction as to ETS.
Okay.
If you're through with that sentence, then your time is more than up. So
thank
we'll
you,
hear
Your Honor.
From Mr. Stern on behalf of the government.
Okay.
You have 25 minutes on liability, including light cigarettes, and then we'll give you 14 back on likelihood of future.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The defendants in their argument this morning made two primary
points. Remember that the acoustics in here are not very good at all.
I think I'm having that problem again, too. Is this any better? The defendants this morning made two primary points about liability. One is on specific intent, and the other one was that the defendant's conduct with respect to lights, low TARs, and so forth was authorized by the FTC. I think there were some other arguments also, but I think that was those were the primary points made with respect to liability. I'm happy to talk about any of the issues that are raised anywhere in the briefs or the opinion, but
With their argument that I was just discussing with Mr. Estrada. They say that the district court didn't identify which acts form the pattern. And my question to you is, what acts did the court find made up the pattern?
the pattern of racketeering activity.
Yeah, which acts made up the pattern of racketeering acts? And where do we find that in the opinion? And
well, I think that the pattern of racketeering activity, including the predicate acts, but not limited to them, is that they created a scheme.
No, that's not what I'm asking you. I know her description of the scheme. I'm asking, where do I look? That's what they argue. You saw their argument, right? They say they can't find the list. They can't find the acts that she found that made up the pattern of racketeering activity. There's lots of findings.
There is a pattern requirement.
No, there is a pattern.
And
I don't think the district court was required to give a list of, say, of certain acts.
If we don't know what they are, how do we know whether the liability finding can stand? And more important, how do we know whether the remedy is tailored to the violation?
We know that the pattern, for example, let's take the issues of the related issues of addiction, lights, cigarettes, and nicotine manipulation. We know that the pattern has been to deceive through a variety of means and through collusion, the public about the nature of light cigarettes, about the defendant's activities in terms of...
So I take it, having read your brief and listened to your answer so far, you don't know, right, any more than I do, what the acts are, that the specific acts that make up the pattern.
It's not so much that I don't know which, it's that I'm sort of at a loss to shorten the list.
Where would you find in the opinion of the district court the best statement of what constituted the pattern, the RICO element, the pattern element of RICO?
If you could find the...
I don't think this is a sandbag argument.
No, it's not a sandbag argument. I guess I'm just a little... I'm just a little bit at a loss, and I apologize, Your Honor, for not fully...
Well, I could tell that from your brief. The government didn't really answer the question in your brief either, which is why I'm asking it now. I read this argument in the blue brief, and then I read your response and did not see an answer to the question. Now, maybe your answer is, well, you don't need it. You didn't say that either.
The argument that is being made that you were discussing with Mr. Estrada is whether this injunction is so vague that...
Well, that's not my question. That's not what I'm talking about. I wasn't talking about the vagueness of the injunction.
Co-counsel to look to see if they can find the district court's best statement on the pattern. If I could, I'm not sure that...
But let me just give you an example, okay? Maybe you would say, okay, there's 148 listed at... there's 148 acts listed at Joint Appendix 3410, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, my law clerks went through at least some of that list, and they found at least 13, and they didn't finish the list. They couldn't find comparable findings of fact for 13 of them. So that list can't be the list, right?
The list of the racketeering acts?
Yeah.
I don't know that any of the racketeering acts is actually in dispute. I'm happy to go through many of the racketeering acts that clearly are discussed in the district court's opinion, and the district court makes specific note in its opinion of, at various points, it indicates which of the predicate acts are associated with various aspects of defendant's mail fraud, and the court indicates that clearly in the opinion. And there's no doubt that the court there's some of these racketeering acts that go to deceptions by each of the defendants and by their spokesman through the Tobacco Institute on making statements about false statements at times when the defendants knew that they were incorrect. And Your Honor referred in your colloquy with Mr. Carvin to a 1971 television appearance by the head of Philip Morris, and in which which was a racketeering act, one of the predicate acts. And in that interview, as Your Honor quoted, Mr. Coleman says, we have no evidence that we don't accept. There's no evidence that smoking causes disease. And while some women may want smaller babies, there's no evidence that there, that this is a problem.
Is it your argument that it is sufficient that the court found a number of racketeering acts and therefore that from that we may infer a pattern? Or, and you know, therefore, the court didn't need to put forth what a pattern
I think, yes, that the pattern is spell, I mean, the pattern sort of is there in these acts. It's, I mean, it is repeated in so many ways. And again, at the highest levels of the company. I mean, this primary argument that's being made, the one sort of real sort of, one of the two legal arguments, because remember, as Mr. Estrada says, none of the fact findings are being challenged. None. So, and a lot of, and these so-called legal arguments can really only be advanced by sort of fairly much insistently not looking at the facts. Because the district court, in its discussion of specific intent, addresses all the arguments that are made here today. The district court, like, heard this business about good faith at the highest levels. The court specifically finds that in the majority of cases, the authors of the fraudulent statements alleged as racketeering acts were executives, including high-level scientists, CEOs, vice presidents, heads of research and development. Another, the court says, findings of fact are replete with examples of each of the companies either willfully stating something which they knew to be untrue or recklessly disregarding their falsity of their statements. And on the issue of fact versus opinion, the court says that it is absurd to think that these high-level officials, given what they like knew, in addition to the cases in which it's absolutely clear that they just know that what they're saying is false, given the levels of knowledge at the top of the corporation over time, the court says it strains credulity. If you needed a credibility finding, there is a credibility finding.
What about all the statements? I hear your point about these statements by officials, okay? But the district court also refers to lots and lots of unattributed statements, press releases, advertisements, and things like that, which are issued in the name of the corporate defendants themselves. And then she says, where such statements are directly contradicted, the internal knowledge of the company's specific intent is easily established. Now, that's not correct, right?
No, I don't think, taken in isolation.
That's the wrong legal standard, right?
Right. No, it's not.
So what do you do about all these?
Look, there are statements that, I mean, it's a very long opinion, and there are statements that can be taken out of this opinion that in isolation sound troublesome.
But what about these? There's some 30 of these unattributed press releases and ads. In other words, they're not the statements by high-level officials.
No, but they don't have to be. Uh-huh. The issue with specific intent in these corporations is essentially, we're just looking to see, are these corporations actually engaged in the act of the fraud, or are these things that the corporation really, like, either doesn't know?
How do you attribute the intent from those 30 or so unattributed statements to the corporation?
You don't, I mean, Your Honor, not all of the statements.
I mean, I suppose one answer is, well, she could have said, look, these were obviously issued with the approval of high-level officials, and those high-level officials obviously knew what the research in their corporation said or showed, right? But I couldn't find that anywhere in here.
Well, Your Honor, what you can certainly find, you can certainly find countless statements and also acts that are authorized at the highest levels of the corporation. And the point about them is that the defense are making is, well, how do we know that these weren't a matter of good faith opinion at the time that they were made? I mean, that is the argument that is being made to you. And the district court answers that.
I think that is the other side of the coin of the argument being made. They're not saying, how do we know they weren't good faith opinions? They don't have to show that. You have to show they're fraudulent.
Exactly.
How do we know that they are made with specific intent to defraud.
Well, they are made with, you show the requisite intent. That
you got to show knowledge and intent.
By showing that you either knew it or it was reckless disregard of what you should have known. And what we have here, and it's laid out in hundreds of fact findings, we have knowledge, and it's often knowledge that is, defendants sort of, I'll make the argument, well, you're not trying to argue that you walled off the top guys. You know, go, absolutely right. We're not trying to argue that the top guys were walled off. Our point is that the top guys knew about all of this, and they had to, because a lot of these things that are done have to come from the top, including all of the instances of moving research overseas, shutting down laboratories when they're producing results that the top of the corporation doesn't like. There's one study of nicotine addiction. It's presented, I think it's to the head of Philip Morris. Philip Morris says, look, I'm not endangering like $1 billion here for like, you know, this rat, like sort of going after nicotine. The thing is shut down. We've got several instances over time of the district court not only having the false statements, but having the executives get together and go, this research is bad, this gets shut down. This research is troubling to do in the United States, we move it overseas. When InfoTab gets set up, that's chairman to chairman. Mr. Carmen refers to some organization called InfBio. Well, you know, it's easy to make fun of this alphabet soup of this organizations, but InfBio
doesn't get to make fun of anyone else for alphabet
soup. We never do, Your Honor. But InfBio is in fact set up results. It's an acquisition abroad, made in 1970 when the head of Philip Morris, in discussions with Mr. Wakeman, the head of R&D, Your Honor mentioned earlier, says, I'd like to move this abroad where we will have fewer repercussions from this environmental tobacco science. Look, at every stage, it is the top people, and it is the top people who meet at the Tobacco Institute. It is the executive committee and the committee of counsel. And this, the court's findings couldn't be more detailed.
I realize we have probably taken you off the order you wish to present today, but if you could remember that you need to address the light issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I certainly would like to address the light issue. And again, the argument is being made there that the FTC actually authorized that defendants essentially are merely acting consistently with what the FTC required, which is clearly not the case. I'm just trying to flip to there. I mean, there's some really extraordinary, I have to understand, in 1998, we're talking here about these descriptors, light and low tar and so forth. In 1997, the FTC says, should we start regulating them? We've never regulated those. And the defendants, in joint comments submitted to the FTC, which really don't harmonize that well with what's being said here today, say, oh, no, the manufacturers are not convinced that there's a need for official guidance with respect to the terms used in marketing low-rated cigarettes. And then, in response to questions, the manufacturers are not convinced that compensatory smoking behavior is a sufficiently common or documented phenomenon that consumers should be alerted
that
to its existence.
That may be incorrect. It may be a reprehensible behavior. But is the use of light and low tar fraud, a RICO predicate act with reference to cigarettes that are conceded by everyone to be lower in tar than the corresponding brand?
First, just even the use of the numbers. I mean, the argument about the FTC is, well, look, you approved
there's
the use
no
of
question.
The numbers.
The FTC not only authorized, didn't they require these numbers?
No, what the defendants came and they said they entered into a voluntary agreement, which the FTC said, just as a matter of enforcement action, said, okay, you know, if that's what you're going to do, you're going to report, you're going to use these numbers, that's fine. We won't take action. However, even with respect to those numbers, as
the numbers were based on the methodology of the FTC.
Yes, but what the defendants knew and what the FTC did not know was the nature of
the yes or no. The FTC did prescribe the methodology.
The FTC said, if you're going to do this, use, they wanted one method.
Yes. That's a yes.
It's not prescribed. I mean, look, there's no rulemaking that goes on here. I mean, as the argument.
I think that's a whole lot of our problem. The government elected to try to use a RICO civil action as a rulemaking. There are agencies of the government that could have done in a rulemaking a lot more.
Your Honor, maybe the government could have done a rulemaking. However, I don't think
all of that is not what happened. What happened is the FTC did come up with approval of this methodology.
It didn't approve. Look, even in the, look, no.
I understood the whole case to have been tried on that issue on the theory that the FTC was the method.
Look, this argument that the FTC authorized the use of lights and descriptors and the campaign.
No, that's not what I'm asking you right this minute. I'm asking you if the FTC prescribed the methodology that produced these numbers.
They said yes. I mean, yes.
Yes, and I said that's right. A yes. And then you started talking about the descriptors of lights.
Can I do a yes,
so let's go to the next thing.
Okay.
The FTC did prescribe this methodology. These numbers on the PACs, you don't have any quarrel with the numbers being on the PACs, as I understand it.
Your Honor, what the FTC...
No legal... There's nothing legally wrong with the company putting those numbers on the PACs.
Your Honor, right? That's... In the FTC versus Brown and Williamson case, to which counsel alluded, indeed, there was a problem because the issue in that case, and that was the Barclay cigarette, and the problem there was that the cigarette as smoked, even the use of the numbers, was in fact deceptive. And at the time, Barclays was thought to be an outlier.
In this case, are you challenging the use of the numbers?
We don't have to challenge. We don't rest.
That would be a no. You're not challenging, correct?
Well, no. Your Honor, I don't want. I'm not trying to be
in
difficult.
In this case, you're not challenging the use of the numbers. Am I correct in that?
Your Honor, what?
That's a yes or no.
I'm not sure it is a yes or a no, Your Honor.
Yes or a no. I didn't understand that to be an issue.
It's not, Your Honor, you could take out the use of the numbers and our case doesn't rest on that. All I'm trying to say is, and I think that a review of what the FTC actually said, and that's the important thing, I'm just trying to point out that when the court looks to see what the FTC actually said to the manufacturers about what it could or could not do, and what it said about implied health claims, and it was also based on what the FTC understood.
You've been coming here a long time. And you know that you need to answer my question. Is the government alleging in this case that it was fraud for the, or predicate act, or any other way unlawful, for the manufacturers, the defendants, the numbers produced by the FTC smoking method on their product?
No.
All right, fine. Now, if we're past that.
We are past that, Your Honor.
Past in two questions, if you had been willing to do what you're supposed to do here and answer my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
If we're past that, then how is it fraud for the defendants to use the derivative of that? That is to say that one cigarette is lighter or lower in tar than another cigarette. How is that fraud?
Because whatever you could say about the use of the numbers, the FTC always made clear that it was not in any way countenancing implied health claims or the use of any descriptors. And it's very clear that what the defendants, and there's lots of testimony about this.
Is there a difference in your mind between the phrases low tar on the one hand and light on the other? I mean, low tar is a description of the number, right? Well, if, in other words, if the numbers are okay, what's wrong with the term low tar?
Because the suggestion is that the low, it's being used in a way to convey that your experience as a smoker is going to be that you get less tar, which defendants knew wasn't true. And defendants also knew, and there's testimony from the head of the...
Suppose just instead of printing the low tar numbers on the package, suppose they put them in bold.
The numbers.
Big, bold type.
Your Honor, if all that we had was the numbers in response to Judge Sittel's earlier question, that is not the basis of the claim. It's not the basis of the district
even
court.
Even if they emphasize them, underline them, put them in bold.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. What the defendants know is, and this is what the head...
But see, here's what I don't understand. If the problem with low tar is that, in fact, the smoker doesn't, in fact, get low tar because of compensatory smoking, isn't that also true of the number? In other words, because of compensatory smoking, the smoker will get more tar and nicotine than those numbers reveal. Yet the numbers are okay. Is that right?
That's right. It is the numbers are a problem, but that doesn't mean that the lights are not a separate problem.
I wasn't asking about the lights yet. I was going to get to that next. I was just asking about whether there's a difference between...
No, I think that the numbers are misleading, and the defendants misled regulators about them. And it's not just the FTC. There's testimony from the Surgeon General about the misleading, too. However, Judge Sintel has... encouraged me not to speak about that. And the point is that with respect to lights, whatever one thinks about the numbers and however misleading they may have been, I would like to sort of just make the point that, and as the head of Philip Morris testified, the major influence in perceptions comes from the positioning of the brand, from the advertising, and not from the FTC numbers, which all the surveys show most people have no idea, like, what the number is. There's a survey that part, and like these volumes of fact findings about this, people don't know within 2 milligrams what their actual numbers are. What they know is, am I smoking a cigarette that somebody is claiming is something that is going to give me less of the bad stuff? And the idea that defendants didn't know that that was what they were marketing is really just ridiculous. I mean, the fact findings are sort of
about... But it's not ridiculous for the defendants to argue that we were making a factually true statement and that could not be fraud for a predicate.
If all that there were the statements of the numbers, yep, as Your Honor says, right, we wouldn't be here.
Now, the step that you are saying there's difficulty with, perhaps there is going from number to low. And if the number is, in fact, lower, why isn't that? Now, light is a different question that Judge Tatel may wish to explore further, but simply low, why isn't that still a factually true statement?
It's not just, I mean, the banning...
Why isn't it factually true?
Because it is not true if the statements were just low tar as measured by the sort of Cambridge method. If those were all the ads that ever said, this might be a reasonable point. It's not what the advertising did or was designed to do. And it's not just the descriptors, but the whole point of the campaign was to convince, and part of it was the descriptors. Excuse me.
I will yield to Judge Tatel.
What, with respect to light and these other descriptors, your government's position is the FTC has not approved these. Mr. Estrada's position is the government has. Do you agree with him that we should decide this question without waiting for the Supreme Court to decide good?
I think it's entirely within the court's discretion, and I assume the court.
I know it's within our discretion. Well, we can do it either way.
Well, I mean,
but I'm asking
you. The next 3 years, you get an opinion.
Right. I'm asking you why, since I mean, there is at least a possibility that the Supreme Court will address this precise question in Altria v. Good. Correct?
That's right.
Okay, so why shouldn't we wait?
We're not suggesting to the court that it should wait, or that it shouldn't wait. you know, the court, you know, I presume may have listened to the oral argument, and the court is in a...
You're not encouraging us one way or the other.
That's exactly right. I mean, because we think that our case stands regardless of what the court actually concludes.
If the Supreme Court rules, wait a minute. If the Supreme Court rules that the FTC approved these descriptors, your case stands on this issue?
Well, no, it would certainly be affected. I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's not that would have no impact.
It would have a dramatic impact, wouldn't it?
Excuse me?
Wouldn't it have a fairly dramatic impact?
Yes, it would. Okay. If that's what the Supreme Court holds.
Now, I know your view is, well, the court will never rule that, right? Because the FTC has not approved them, but,
I mean, I'm not going to jump into the fray of quoting from Supreme Court oral arguments.
So you don't think we would be unreasonable to say we will wait for guidance from the Supremes on that?
I do not think that would be unreasonable at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Stern, before you move on to your next subject here, I do want to go back to something you said earlier, which is you said the acts that made up the pattern of racketeering included addiction. I assume you're saying denial of addiction. And I'm wondering, what is the government's position? What is the misrepresentation with regard to addiction?
The position, and it's the district court talks about this at some length, but it's the position what the district court says is you that and they sort of the court addresses the defendant's sort of terminology quibble argument to go, well, you know, we say that it could be, you know, addictive, but not in the sense. And what the court says is, no, that's, you're really, when you do this isn't a quibble, you're omitting the key fact of, like, nicotine, there really is a chemical dependence. And this really matters because people, and particularly young people who are the targets of a lot of advertising, really don't get it about being addicted.
Right. But what Mr. Carvin calls a semantic, and even you say is a quibble, whether we say dependence or addiction.
No, excuse me, Your Honor. What the district court said specifically says defendants claim that this is a quibble, and the court specifically rejects the quibble argument. I mean, again, the court addressed all of these arguments that are being made here. The court explained very carefully why this is not a quibble.
And well, I guess my question is, does the misrepresentation have to be something that you can say, this is a fact and this is not a fact, or does it just have to be what the judge thinks is correct?
The statements that are, first of all, there's some statements that are made that are just entirely incorrect because defendants, like, have gone so far in some of these cases to say, no, there's no dependence. And there are advertisements that say that, I think it's a 1988 release from the Tobacco Institute that says there's no evidence of dependence. And it says this is just like your attachment to things like jogging and candy bars and attraction to members of the opposite sex and the...
That's an addiction.
Well...
Go ahead, Kath.
There's no evidence of that in the record, but and that the distress you will experience from giving up smoking is like giving up those things. I mean, those are some of their public statements. Then they have, and then Mr. Carvin goes, oh, gummy bears. Well, I mean, if the gummy bears were some isolated statement that had nothing to do with anything else, you'd be quite right. But
the gummy bear statement, it is unfair for the government to put any stress on that.
The only point that we make about the gummy bears is that, in fact, that is actually the position that the defendants have taken in lots of ads.
That was not made in advertising.
No.
Or any public forum.
No, but what it, to the extent that what we're interested in is, like, what is everybody doing in total? What is the nature of this enterprise and so forth? These things are relevant. We're not relying upon it, obviously, as a predicate act. But the point, Judge Brown, is that the defense have made lots of just patently untrue statements, and this, and the district court makes lots of findings about the difference between what they want to say and are currently saying and why it's misleading, why the current statements on their websites are misleading, what they testify to a trial.
I'm capriciously start your second 14 minutes now, and it's going to be flexible on subject matter instead of being just remedies, but if we don't do that, we could wind up with you being up all day, and that wouldn't be fair to you or the other side. The second 14 minutes now begins. Get to remedies during that 14 minutes. If you need to further answer, Judge Rogers, go ahead. Judge Brown, go ahead.
It sort of segues, I mean, into the remedies, because the court's discussion.
Well, before you get to remedies, since Judge Sentell said this is an open period, I just want to ask you a quick question. I just want to ask you a quick question about materiality and particularly the denial of marketing to youth. Okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Why, can you explain to me why that is material to whether what judgments or decisions a smoker would make, a reasonable smoker to make, as to whether or not the company is in fact marketing to youth?
Your Honor, we're not relying on the denials of the marketing to youth sort of independently. Our only point about the youth marketing, which we do think is very significant, is that the defendants know that the youth, and there's lots of evidence about this in the record, that the youth are the most likely to believe what's being said. They're the most likely to think that they aren't going to be addicted, that they can just give it up.
But you're not relying on that for this second. Okay.
Right. And
the remedies there.
Right. And again,
sort of remedies there too.
Sure.
You know, but I do think that I think Mr. Carvin said, well, you know, what difference does any of this like make? Because, well, this was all a long time ago and now we all agree, that it either is or isn't addictive or it's not harmful and so forth. And again, these are only arguments that can be made by ignoring the fact findings. And the district court very carefully goes through and explains what the defendants are currently saying, looks at their current websites, looks at their testimony at trial, and says, on the basis of each of all of these things, this is why I think that there is a real likelihood that you are going to continue doing what you're doing. And the court says, look, you are doing, even after this lawsuit was filed, you've been engaging in conduct that was materially indistinguishable from the conduct before. And defendant's primary argument for why the district court just must be wrong is the master settlement agreement. I mean, that's sort of the sort of silver bullet argument. And we think that would just sort of, while that could be relevant to what remedies the court could order, it couldn't be that in and of itself, just even just as a legal matter, it could explain why the defendants couldn't in the future or won't commit more fraud. However, the district court made a lot of findings about the master settlement agreement, including both what it covers and the way in which defendants have been complying with it. And the court asked, do the terms of the settlement agreement extend forward indefinitely, or do they have an end? And the answer was, well, no end with respect to the most important ones. I'd like to go back to some of the ones that may not be the most important ones, but do have some importance, such as the requirement of keeping the document depositories. The physical document depository requirement expired this year, and I think it's only being kept alive because defendants know that this suit is going on. The internet depository requirement expires in 2 years. So absent this lawsuit, this injunction, nothing keeps those in place. the state attorney general's ability to get document inspection, as the district court detailed in its opinion, that starts being phased out in the near future too. So that to the extent, as the court said, that that was going to provide some transparency and help out in enforcement, that's going away also. What defendants mean when they say that some provisions last forever, it's essentially just that the Tobacco Institute and the Center for Tobacco Research were required to be abolished.
What's the government's answer to the defendant's argument that the district court got the burden of proof wrong on this question? You didn't answer that in your brief at all.
Your Honor, I was looking back over the opinion to try and find where the court could have gotten it wrong.
Here, I'll read it to you. Here's what she says. She says in a footnote when she's discussing the MSA, she says, a defendant seeking to escape a permanent injunction bears the burden of demonstrating that subsequent events make it absolutely clear that the alleged wrongful behavior could not reasonably be expected to reoccur.
Thank you for honoring me, Your Honor.
Right. They cited that in the blue brief, and you didn't respond to it at all.
Yeah, well,
it does look to me like, the district court made her reasonable likelihood determination without regard to the MSA and then treated the MSA as if it was, an offer that, sort of mootness, that the case would not likely reoccur.
Honor, the footnote, if the footnote reflected what the district court had done in the text and the very long text of the opinion, then I think there would be a problem. But that really isn't what the court did. And the court didn't treat the MSA as if it were inconsequential. But again, also one thing about
You said what?
The court didn't treat the MSA as if it were inconsequential or not sort of worthy of its consideration or irrelevant to what defendants were going to do.
But the district court's original determination that defendants are likely to commit further violations, that was made without regard to the MSA. Then the district court starts a new section on the MSA.
It's a very long opinion, and the court was clearly aware of what was going to be
on one
page.
In the next section. This is the only place where it's discussed.
The court is essentially talking. What the court is doing is saying, is there a reasonable likelihood of future violations? Yes. Then, okay, how does the MSA affect my analysis?
Shouldn't that judgment of whether there's a reasonable likelihood of future acts have included an assessment of the MSA?
But it does, because it then...
No, it doesn't. The district court considers that next. It's a long opinion, but this section's pretty clear. After she determines, without any reference to the MSA, after she determines, without any reference to that, that they're likely to commit further violations, the opinion then begins a new section at 3342. The title of which is, the MSA is not sufficiently altered. Okay, that's the title. And then the district court analyzes the MSA and then drops the footnote. So what the district court did was the burden of proof is on the government. You agree with that, right?
Excuse me, the court.
Isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Footnote 46.
Yes.
Where you're supposed to be.
Yeah, that's the that we do. I agree that that's. It's taken by itself. if that was the court's analysis, that would be mistaken. I really don't, look, the court's opinion is what it is. What I don't think that the court reasonably can be thought to be doing was to disregard the impact of the MSA.
No, I didn't say that. Excuse me, Mr. Stern, I didn't say that. I think well, let me just try it this way, because I don't want to take up all your time on this question, but the burden of proof to show likely continued violations is on the government, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so that, and so the government presumably has to show that notwithstanding the MSA, the defendants are likely to commit further acts, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. What the district court did was, the district court made the judgment that the defendants are likely to commit further acts, and then separately looked at the MSA and asked whether the defendants had proved that the MSA was sufficient to show they would not.
I understand. Okay. No,
Do you agree with that reading?
No.
No,
I don't, but the, again, what could it, the, what's important is what the, this actually shows, and even if the district court had mistakenly thought that the MSA was some kind of affirmative defense and that the burden had shifted to the defendants, it would still be entirely clear that the MSA can't do what the defendants want it to do, both because its injunctive provisions are not coextensive with those of this order, because it is not enforceable by the United States, and because the MSA doesn't even touch a lot of what the heart of the government's case was, which has to do with nicotine addiction and light cigarettes. The MSA is essentially embodies a damages remedy based on sort of state, damages claims for healthcare. Most of the MSA is involved with how that money gets split up. There's some limited injunctive provisions, some of which are currently expiring, and the provisions that defendants rely on as making it impossible for them to continue to do anything are the fact that the Tobacco Institute and the Center for Tobacco Research are disbanded. That is what this all comes down to, and that cannot be the basis for saying that there is no likelihood for future conduct. And the district court makes lots of findings about why that's not true, including goes through the First City factors in detail, goes through the various, even if you thought you needed organizations in which to conduct your future collusion, there are a ream of organizations that the district court describes in its opinion, and all the defendants in their brief say, well, we're not a, say about some of them, well, we're not a member of that. Well, if they're not a member, some of them they're associates of, and a lot of which they fund. But the point is simply, do they have the ongoing opportunities through various vehicles to continue That's what they were doing?
Cutting you short, I think you probably addressed that as you were going, and I wanted to ask you about a rather specific and perhaps to some trivial part of the remedial proceeding. But the idea of controlling point of what must be displayed at point of sale advertising, how can that be done without regulating the conduct of third parties not before the court?
Well,
you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, no, I do.
The signage in other people's stores, and the order, I can look for the page, but I'm not going to. The order says that the defendant shall require people with whom they're in sales agreements to put this signage in their stores. Isn't that... Where's the due process in making store owners put up a bunch of signs, assuming that they can work, that it's within the compass of the defendants to require that?
I think that what the order, which as Your Honor says, is a relatively sort of minor part of the order until, but
it is to us, but it's probably very important to the intervener.
I think that the idea of telling a manufacturer that you have to arrange for certain kinds of warnings is not itself sort of inherently problematic.
But going back to the very first question, the fundamental point of whether you can require signage by parties not before the court, how can the court do that?
Well, I think it's a
These
question.
These parties were not, they were not parties to the litigation.
No, but it's, I think it's a question of, you know, of, I mean, lots of manufacturers require that lots of things be put up by stores selling their products. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they do this as a matter of contract.
You're just saying they have to enforce this on their contractors.
Yes, that's right.
You're saying first they have to get it into the contract.
That's right.
And I don't know how you can require a two-party contract to have something based on one of the parties having been in court and been told to include it.
Your Honor, I think if there were difficulties with that aspect of it, I don't think it's inherently unenforceable. If there were problems, that's certainly something that could be brought to
the district court. Well, I'm going further than that. If there are no problems still, how does the court have the authority to enforce the conduct of an independent party to a contract who isn't before the court?
Well, I mean, certainly as an abstract matter, it's simply a question of saying you will include this as
again,
part of your contract.
It may be abstract, you and me, but it's a party not before the court.
No, but, but it's entering into a contract, and there are lots of conditions of a contract, and the court is saying.
What about, there's another aspect, since Chief Judge Sinthal brought that up, there's another aspect of that argument that I wanted to ask you about. They say that this part of the decree requires duplicative displays. In other words, if a retailer is carrying the cigarettes of five different companies, the retailer is going to have five different sets of corrective ads.
Yeah, I mean, we just disagree that
You disagree because that's not. I mean, I looked at the decree. The decree says. Says that each defendant that utilizes a retailer shall have these displays. So, I mean, how can, that's clearly what it requires.
Your Honor, we really don't, I mean, again, it there would be, if that is what the court meant, that would probably be a sort of abuse of discretion and equity. We don't think that that's what the court meant
to
do.
What's the best part of the agreement or the order that you can cite to show that that's not what the court meant? I understand you argued that to us. I'm not sure that I understood the basis of your argument.
I mean, I don't think I've got any.
If I were trying to comply with that order and avoid contempt, and I were one of the manufacturers, and I came in and said, well, I didn't need to because somebody else had done it. What could I point to in my defense?
Right. You could certainly point to the fact that the government agrees that you don't need to.
So that's today?
The order has been stayed, and certainly the district court could also.
You're asking us be affirmed.
I'm asking that it be affirmed, but based on understanding of what we do think that the court meant. And
let me ask you a related question.
There's a problem about it. We don't have a problem with the court saying.
No, your view is we shouldn't rely on what the decree says. We should rely on what the district court meant.
Your Honor, if the court believes that it can't, that it has to be read that way, and the court.
You know, that's what they used to say about the real Mayor Daley. Do you know about that? The original one?
No.
They used to say to him after his press conferences when he made misstatements, they would say to him, don't listen to what the mayor says, listen to what he meant.
Right.
Well, let me ask you a related question. I'm talking about the original Mayor Daley, not the current one. the defendants say the injunction can't enjoin foreign conduct that has no substantial U.S. effect. And you agree with that, right?
Yes.
But that's not what the decree says. Anything in the decree that says that?
To the extent that the decree says otherwise, we don't have a problem with the court making clear that it can't go further than that.
And can I interpret that argument as the same answer to the question about duplicate displays?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Can I take that argument as also applying to duplicative displays?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
I hate to extend this still further, but your answer to the question of extraterritorial enforcement of the decree raises, at least in my mind, the question of whether RICO is extraterritorial at all or not. I don't want to open you up to a 15-minute argument with maybe what it would take, but is it your position that RICO applies extraterritorially?
I'm reminded by counsel that, yes, it applies to conduct abroad that has effects in the United States.
Beg your pardon?
That it applies to conduct abroad that has effects in the United States.
It would go to the effects test.
Yes.
And say that here.
Yes. And that, and
as far
that,
as the effects test.
Yes.
Okay.
And that is what we are concerned
you're
with.
Taking you beyond the subject you're supposed to be arguing here, but yeah. That one sort of came up.
Yeah.
I think we are now past your time by somewhat. You got 5 minutes?
Past
I'm sorry. He's 5 minutes past his time, yes.
Yes.
You're 5 minutes past your time, so I guess we will call this to an end.
I'm okay. Are you? Yeah.
We'll proceed then. Thank you, counsel. Let's see what's next on the agenda. I believe that was the last time we're supposed to. No, that's not. We have Mr. Crystal next. Had we given Mr. Stern all of his times? Well, you have another 14 minutes if you want to use it, I think. I'm sorry. We did jump ahead to remedies without looking.
I think I've gotten, I just want to make sure that there's nothing that with respect, because I believe that
I
deal
got
with all aspects
okay,
of appeal, cross appeal, and so
you
forth.
You probably really
right?
got as many minutes as you were entitled to. We didn't
yes, Your Honor, I just want to make sure that there are no questions about any aspect.
Unless there's further questions, then we'll move to Mr. Crystal.
Intervener opening argument, Mr. Crystal.
Good morning, Your Honors. It is still morning. Howard Crystal for the Public Health Interveners. Your Honors, the District Court made a mistake in ruling that this Court's earlier disgorgement decision precluded the District Court from even considering remedies such as smoker cessation, public education, and youth smoking reduction as appropriate equitable remedies in this case. Now, turning to Section 1964, which we discussed earlier this morning, that statute specifically provides that among a court's equitable powers in imposing remedies are to, quote, require any person to divest himself of any interest, direct or indirect, in any enterprise. In this case, according...
No question, it says.
It says that, Your Honor. Yes, that's right.
Question being, how is that relevant?
Well, let me explain, Your Honor. The defendants themselves, and this is, it's in the record, it's cited in our briefs, it's in the joint appendix, the defendants themselves consider addicted smokers to be their asset. They, quote, characterize addicted smokers, and I'm quoting now, as a valuable long-term asset that, quote, compounds over time. They discuss, and again, this
There's
is
no
in the record.
No legal sense in which a human being is an asset.
Well, Your Honor, I
we
think...
We had an amendment about that. You can't own another human being. That has nothing to do with this statute.
Well, Your Honor, our argument with regard to divestment is that within the court's equitable authority... includes the court's authority to provide remedies that will address the future prospective...
That will prevent and restrain
yes.
violations of Section 1962.
That's right. Now, among the remedies that the defendants themselves agree a court could impose, for example, would be to rescind an unlawful contract, that to divest the defendant of an interest that it obtained unlawfully... through a contract of extortion, for example. Here, what we have is a contract of addiction that the defendants, through their misconduct, have tricked the smokers into becoming part of, the result of which is that addicted smokers continue to provide an income stream to the defendants every day or every time they buy another pack of cigarettes. So our argument with regard to divestment, Your Honor, is that the statute permits the court, within its equitable authority, to impose smoker cessation, to divest the defendants of the only asset that they actually have. The association, in fact, enterprise here, its asset is addicted smokers and the continuing income stream that it obtains from those addicted smokers. And our submission is that, for example, in Shine Theaters, the Supreme Court in the antitrust context, and of course, the RICO Section 1964 is modeled on the antitrust laws, the court described divestment as, quote, an equitable remedy designed to undo what could have been prevented had the defendants not outdistanced the government from their unlawful project. And here, our submission is that that's exactly what's occurred as a result of the defendant's misconduct. that they've acquired this asset of addicted smokers, and that's appropriate within the court's equitable authority to order divestment of that asset. In addition, the cessation and the
public... You are asking the court to hold that human beings can be assets.
Yes, Your Honor, we are. And one case to cite, Your Honors, too, there is a Third Circuit decision cited in our briefs where the Third Circuit upheld the district court's order on the grounds of divestment of ordering the members of a union board, the members who were participating in the enterprise, to no longer be on the board, finding that is well within the court's broad equitable authority of divestment.
That's not remotely parallel to asking them to fund programs to keep other people from being on the board.
I understand, Your Honor.
You don't have any authority.
And there's no question that this is a unique case and a unique situation, but we do think it's within the court's broad equitable authority. Now, in addition, the smoking cessation and public education remedies are also appropriate to eliminate the effects of the defendant's violation. And now I'm quoting from the Supreme Court's antitrust decision in Ford, cited in our briefs, which talked about a court's equitable authority in the context of preventing and restraining violations to, quote, cure the ill effects of illegal conduct. This court, in the Warner case, in the Novartis case, allowed remedies, those were under a cease and desist authority, allowed remedies that would address ongoing, lingering consumer confusion that results as a result of prior misconduct. Here, particularly the public education remedy that, again, the district court refused to even consider, is a critical equitable power of the district court to address the ongoing future prospective effects of defendants' misconduct. Now, I'm talking both about the past misconduct, and of course, I'm talking about the ongoing misconduct that the district court found by the totality of circumstances will occur. In addition, even under the most restrictive reading of the court's earlier disgorgement decision, the district court did not consider the record evidence that explained the effect that these remedies would have on the defendant's future misconduct. And again, I think it's critical for the court to focus on, there was some discussion earlier this morning about the test. The first city test from this circuit with regard to future violations is, number one, did the violations form part of a pattern? Number two, were they deliberate and flagrant, or were they merely technical? And number three, will there be future opportunities for violations? I think the district court, again, if you look at the opinion, went through all parts of that test and found overwhelmingly that there will be future opportunities, that there was a pattern, and that pattern was deliberate. And on that basis, applying the appropriate test, found that future violations would occur. So again, what I'm suggesting is that if we put aside the divestment argument and we put aside the effects, even under a restrictive view of the disgorgement appeal, where the only remedies that could be permitted are ones that are going to address specifically future violations, the district court did not consider the evidence that the government put forth. The government had experts who testified, this is unrebutted testimony, that public education and smoker cessation will have a specific effect on the defendant's future conduct because they no longer will have the pool of addicted smokers.
It's not a question of having an effect on defendant's future conduct. Any injunction is going to have an effect on the future conduct. It's whether that is comes within the language to prevent and restrain violations.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Section that
I understand. And
that defines the limit of the court's jurisdiction.
Yes.
It then gives examples within that set, but it's not a question of affecting their conduct.
What I meant by the conduct what I'm talking about are the RICO violations themselves. Mm-hmm. And again, the record evidence, which the district court has not considered, that evidence suggests that if the public is educated, particularly youth now, of course, youth and the public are educated with regard to the true nature of addiction, the true nature of the adverse health effects of smoking, the true nature of the effects of environmental tobacco smoke, of nicotine manipulation, and of course, joined with that, once they have the knowledge, they have available to them the remedies, the cessation therapies that will allow them to free themselves of addiction, that the defendants will no longer have the audience for their fraud that they've had up to now. And the result of that will be they'll have less incentive. Judge Williams, in the disgorgement appeal, talked about the defendant's misconduct being affected by, quote, the returns to crime versus the possible costs. The record evidence that the district court had not yet considered, cited in our briefs, is that as a result of the remedies that she has not yet considered, and this includes, of course, the youth smoking remedy, which would provide a penalty to defendants if they can't reduce youth smoking by certain levels, that these remedies...
Yeah, that to me, I don't understand at all how you think a court can do that. If you don't accomplish a particular change in somebody else's behavior, then you're violating the order of the court. Have you got any authority where a court's ever been upheld doing that?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, that's third-party behavior. Not that's third-party, it's millions of third parties' behavior, and if they don't successfully change somebody else's behavior, then they're in violation of the order. Has the court ever done that?
I understand the court's concern, and I don't think so. But with regard to sort of, I think, the first part of your question, in terms of a court ordering a remedy that will address future conduct in the kind of way we're talking about, particularly with regard to public education.
That we can hold a court made error for not considering a kind of relief nobody's ever considered before, and that frankly doesn't make a great deal of sense, even in your argument of affecting third parties' behavior. And if you fail to affect the third party behavior, you have to pay a penalty.
I understand the court's concern. Again, if I could just turn back to the public education and the smoker cessation.
You're the one that brought that issue up here. If we're taking your time on that away from your other issues, you shouldn't have brought it.
I understand, Your Honor. The error of the district court that we are appealing is the district court was of the view that in light of the disgorgement decision, it, as a matter of law, that it could not even consider smoking cessation in public education, that it was beyond the court's equitable authority. And what we're suggesting is that the district court, in the first instance, should look at the record evidence that suggests that those remedies will, in fact, impact the defendant's future RICO violations, because it will affect their incentives to commit violations, because it will impact their target audience. And in addition, the court has the authority to do it based on the effects that the prior misconduct has had, and that finally, that it can do it under its divestment authority. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to respond to some of the questions that came up before. First, Judge Brown, I think your colloquy with Mr. Stern on denial of addiction illustrates as best I can why the specific intent requirement needs to be rigorously policed, so we don't allow semantic ambiguities to put people in jail. That is why every case, including this circuit in Dale, has said it is their burden to negate every reasonable interpretation of the word at issue. And nobody can argue that a reasonable interpretation of addiction doesn't include what the Surgeon General believed until 1988. Then you ask him, well, how did we lie? And he changes the subject. He says, well, we denied dependence. Well, I didn't realize dependence was now on the glossary of the government's terms that we had to admit to. They're, once again, changing their theory from trial. And if you want to put us on that semantic merry-go-round, I would point out that at footnote 14, page A3243, Judge Kessler says dependence equals withdrawal. Well, it's undisputed that we admitted the same withdrawal symptoms. I can't think of a better illustration of how it's absolutely impossible for us to avoid jail cells unless we acquiesce to everything that pops into the Surgeon General's head on this completely academic and historical debate. The other point I would like to make about specific intent that we haven't gotten to, which is relevant to both ETS and addiction, is you need to show specific intent not only to lie, but a lie that's supposed to deprive a consumer of money or property. That's a requirement of the fraud statutes, well established. Well, she never found that that was our intent. In fact, every factual finding shows precisely the opposite. At page 3345 of the joint appendix, I'm sorry, paragraph 3345, page 2944, she found repeatedly that the reason we were fighting about ETS was to fend off indoor air restrictions and adverse agency findings. We were doing what Norr Pennington entitles us to do in a free society, stop the government from regulating us in a way that we find detrimental. It wasn't to defraud consumers, it was to fend off adverse regulation. At paragraph 1147, A2179, she says the industry had paid sparse attention to addiction until 1988.
What JA page was that?
I'm sorry, that was A2179. We hadn't even paid attention to the word addiction until the Surgeon General decided to apply the most pejorative label possible to us, and we responded in the way that any industry would in a debate concerning public policy. And there is not a fraud case anywhere in the federal reports that has ever suggested that what trade associations say with respect to public policy
or to proposed regulation comes within a million miles of the fraud statutes. And even if it did, it would be core First Amendment protected activity. And I can't believe the government thinks that federal courts can impose prior restraints or penalties on that kind of core speech. The other point, which is also related to that, is in response to Judge Tatel's question. You asked, and Mr. Stern was obviously unable to answer, where are the racketeering acts that we were supposed to be given due notice of in defending this case? Well, they're nowhere in the opinion. So we don't know what the racketeering acts were. We do know that they couldn't prove a case. Why did she not, in this humongous opinion, just identify the racketeering acts? Because it couldn't support her injunction. Most obviously with respect to ETS. They were limited to the 148 racketeering acts that they had appended to their complaint. Read the complaint. It's in the joint appendix. They don't mention ETS. It wasn't even a fraud theory. They don't propose any racketeering acts. And if you go to her part of the opinion, where she would drop footnotes occasionally, at the end of discussing our various frauds, this would be at A3255, see if there's any footnotes with respect to ETS that even reference the racketeering acts. It wasn't part of their case. It wasn't part of their theory. She nonetheless goes ahead and finds all these findings and enjoins us. Nicotine manipulation. There was five proposed racketeering acts. All were connected to the 1994 Waxman hearings. She finds, as clear as a bell, that all of that is protected under Norah Pennington. Nonetheless, finds it fraudulent, enjoins it, enjoins constitutionally protected speech. She couldn't rely on their racketeering acts to cobble together this huge fraud theory that they've come up with, and therefore that's why she never identified the racketeering acts, because it revealed the Potemkin village that has been their case from the beginning. Third, the government tries to cover up the complete gaps in evidence in the fraudulent schemes by saying, well, look, one fraud scheme is as good as seven. If you find that there's a fraud scheme with respect to causation in the 1960s, because the Tobacco Institute waited way too long to admit that smoking causes disease, which we admit, then you can enjoin lights in 2008 and ETS in 2008, because they lump it together under some huge fraudulent scheme. Well, Microsoft makes as clear as a bell that you can't enjoin something that's not illegal. They have to show that we mailed in furtherance of a scheme to defraud. Well, if we had no scheme to defraud with respect to lights or ETS or addiction, you can't enjoin it. You have to tailor the remedy to the violation.
I thought her findings on light cigarettes did support. I thought that she did find that the advertisements and press releases on and statements on light cigarettes were themselves fraudulent and related to the and in furtherance of the scheme.
Oh no, 2 points. Right. I'm just saying right? I'll let Mr. Estrada deal with the specifics of the lights fraud. I'm just saying you need to find fraud with respect to lights. Their theory seems to be this humongous enterprise. If they prove a fraud theory with respect to denying smoking causes disease, that somehow that enables the court under this amorphous concept of RICO to enjoin us on lights, a completely unrelated thing, because it all comes under the umbrella of cigarettes
and health. But if the scheme she has found is a scheme to defraud cigarette smokers, that's the scheme. And there are RICO predicate acts for each corporation that support that. There's at least two. Now, there's other evidence of mailings and press releases that relate to light cigarettes, and she finds that all of those are in furtherance of the scheme. What more does she need to do?
She needs to say that saying lights is fraudulent. You can't simultaneously say, no, lights is perfectly truthful and legitimate and endorsed by the FTC. But because they committed fraud about causation, I am nonetheless going to enjoin this utterly truthful speech. That's what you can't do, and that's the absurd theory they're bringing in force. Even if basic remedial principles didn't stop courts from enjoining activity that's perfectly lawful.
A mailing does not itself have to be fraudulent. It has to be fraudulent.
Yes.
And the mailing has to be in furtherance of the scheme.
Oh, I absolutely agree.
And she found a fraudulent scheme,
but she
found that the mailings are in furtherance of it.
Judge Tatel, I fully agree. If she found that there was a fraudulent scheme with respect to lights, obviously she could enjoin it. What I'm saying is if she found there was no fraudulent scheme with respect to
She found there was an overall scheme to defraud smokers.
But yeah.
And the evidence regarding light cigarettes supports that.
Okay. And if the evidence supporting that is wrong because it's not fraudulent, how in the world can you enjoin it? Let's assume the car companies in 1960s lied when they were fighting with Ralph Nader about seatbelts. Is it remotely possible that a court could find in 2008 that they can't raise completely legitimate concerns about airbags and lighter trucks because of CAFE standards, because they all relate to auto safety? Is it remotely possible that you can impose a prior restraint on perfectly truthful speech without any finding that anybody is harmed from it? Again, even if remedial principles didn't stop the court from expanding its jurisdiction that far, the First Amendment surely would. And that's at the core of this absurd mountain of enterprise where they find one little grain of sand and try and turn it into an injunction that governs our behavior in 2008. I submit there's no principle of remedial jurisdiction or RICO that could possibly support that. And, Your Honor, that relates to your question about what's the problem with injecting the word corporations for individuals associated in fact. The first problem is, of course, that it makes nonsense of the statutory language, which should be the end of it, because the United States admits that the word individuals can't include corporations because corporations are listed next to individuals. And then they say, but Perholtz lets us go beyond the language. And I agree with that for present purposes. But what it doesn't allow you to do is turn the definitional section of a U.S. code statute into an inkblot into which the judiciary can pour whatever its views of proper public policy.
I ask you this, counsel, or on that subject. Suppose instead of these 5, 6, 7 longstanding international corporations, you have 5 individuals who just form corporations the day before they get together to engage in a criminal enterprise. Cannot that not be a RICO if each of them shows up and says, I'm Willie Brown, the president of ABC Corporation. The next one is Carmen Bastillo, president of DEF Corporation. Are they shielded from RICO liability?
That's exactly what Perholtz was concerned about. They're saying, look, the real association here is these individuals, and we're not going to allow the Gambino family to get off the hook because they make themselves Murder Incorporated. That was precisely what Perholtz said, and that's fine for present purposes. You don't want to gut, you don't want to create a loophole in what Congress wanted to get at. Mm-hmm. But here you're not creating a loophole. These are corporations who were behind the supposed scheme, right? And this gives the government tremendous advantages. They get to attribute statements made in 1950.
You would make that a fact-specific ruling in this case rather than a ruling that corporations, organization of corporations, can't be encompassed by that section?
I want you to peacefully coexist with Perholtz. And what Perholtz said was, look, we're not reaching a situation like you, like this.
Perholtz may not be compelling this result, but it certainly has language from Judge Bork, I guess, that portends this result, doesn't it?
Judge Bork would have never said, no, no. But no, my point is this. Look, the holding doesn't apply because that was individuals using corporations as vehicles. The analysis doesn't apply because you're not avoiding a loophole in what Congress wanted to get at. And the application of the analysis.
How would we write our precedent if we go your way on that?
Very simple standard.
In order to prevent the use of loophole, the creation of loopholes in further cases.
The general standard is anything that's consistent with the statutory definitions is a permissible enterprise. Individuals who are using corporations as their vehicles is consistent with the statutory language. Corporations who are forming together an association, in fact, is not at all consistent with the language. I would adopt what this court used in Philip Morris. How do you interpret the liberal construction rule under Philip Morris? You don't give narrow readings like Perholtz avoided, but what you don't do is create something that gets into new purposes never contemplated by Congress. Well, let's look at the legislative history of RICO. They were worried about individuals.
None of this was contemplated by Congress.
Well, and you know what? That's what
you and I remember the actual adoption of RICO, and it was aimed at the people you referenced a while ago.
And the government, you know what, the government says, look, we've gone well beyond the legislative history. But why? Why has the Supreme Court said it? Because of the language of the statute. It says follow the language. Said it in Turcotte, said it in Shidler. Don't worry about the legislative history. Don't start using the legislative history to change the language. Who's arguing to follow the language in this case? Us, not them. Surely if you have neither legislative history nor language to support this grotesque expansion of RICO into areas never contemplated, then all you're left with is judicial policy. And I would argue that even if you're just trying to get at corporations acting badly, you don't have to adopt their extreme interpretation of RICO. If corporations are enterprises, you can sue the corporations. If two corporations get together and they form a third enterprise, like they allegedly did with the Tobacco Institute here, you can go after that because that's another legal entity. You could go after the Tobacco Institute. Why didn't they allege that? Because the Tobacco Institute was a corpse the day they filed suit. So they couldn't go after a straightforward enterprise like the Tobacco Institute. They had to turn our entire industry into something like the Gambino family, where simply because we market lights in the same way, they can attribute what RJR said in 1953 to what PM was thinking in 1994. Well, if anything was not within the contemplation of Congress, and if anything overrides a specific statutory limitation, it's turning an industry that sells a lawful product into a RICO enterprise simply because all they have is a trade association that's seeking to fend off government regulation. And even if that didn't violate every normal principle of statutory construction, we are again talking about a statute which this court in Yellow Bus says is subject to the rule of lenity, and surely people are entitled to some notice of what kind of things would be in the enterprise, and surely the statutory language has to have some meaning. And their position erases the statutory definition from the statute. The definition of enterprise is precisely the same with or without the statutory definitional section, and the Supreme Court is never going to allow that kind of rewriting of congressional statutes to stand, regardless of how many circuit courts have unthinkingly applied that. Unless there are further questions, I have nothing else. Thank you.
By hearing none.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have some quick points. I don't want to be misquoted as having said that I agree with the fact of findings of the district court. What I said is we're bringing legal challenges to the court. Obviously, we disagree with a lot of what Judge Kessler had to say. And just because you call something a finding also does not make it a finding. As, you know, the Supreme Court said in Pullman Standard versus Swint, you have mixed questions of law and fact, and if you have made a legal error in your approach to the facts, you know, the judgment may be set aside on that basis. After you get a trial in which 60 years of your conduct are on trial, and an appeal in which even with more pages, you cannot possibly address all of that. It is the only thing that we could do to sort of bring the unfairness and the injustice of the whole process in front of the court, and to highlight that this is the type of case that was tried purportedly under a federal criminal trial under circumstances that never would have been permitted if it were a criminal trial. Let me talk about lights. And also want to make plain that our position is that we win whether or not the FTC authorized the descriptors themselves separately from the numbers because, as we made clear at the outset, the descriptors are true. The basic fraud here, according to the government, is knowing basic math and telling others, and that's not a fraud. Having said that, the FTC did authorize the descriptors. There's plenty of stuff in the record. We've gone over it in our briefs. Let me just read you from A4295, which is the letter from the FTC to the National Association of Broadcasters in 1967. This is the commission speaking.
67?
It is 1967. It says A4295, and this is what the commission said. The commission's current enforcement policy in regard to statements of and representations relating to tar and nicotine content of cigarettes may be formulated as follows. As a general rule, the commission will not challenge such statements or representations where they are shown to be accurate and fully substantiated by tests conducted in accordance with the standardized testing methods and procedures used by the Federal Trade Commission as described in its release of August 1st, 1967. We will not challenge the statements or the representations that are related. Their consent decrees in 1971 and 1995 that we put on the record that expressly say in settling with one of the defendants, you know, if something is in fact low in tar under the FTC method, the good may be so represented. Let me turn to a future violations, because it is extremely important that we get, you know, the facts on the table. The government was flat wrong. Let me say that again, flat wrong, when it told the court that the only permanent parts of the MSA are the dissolution of CTR and of the Tobacco Institute. It is flat wrong to say that the injunctions on joint conduct and on material statements, misstatements of fact, are temporary or will go away. That is just, all of those injunctions are permanent. They are at page A7161 of the record. They say you may not get together in any form to lie about tobacco or to hinder research into tobacco. You may not make any material statement of fact concerning the health effects of tobacco. And that goes on forever. The government also said that the MSA was more in the nature of a damages remedy rather than the injunctive relief they seek here. Again, the injunctions are there for all to see, and I think can be read, and, you know, the government certainly has never attempted to show that they're not adequate to police the behavior that was once the enterprise on their telling. Now, there are some things that are due to expire, and as he pointed out, they're the document, the depositories, one, and also the states have some inspection rights under the MSA that will be phased out. Of course, even if those were not available, no one has argued that the absence of those remedies could lead to a RICO violation. But the more important, the more important point is, has anybody in the room not heard of Andrew Cuomo, Elliot Spitzer? Attorneys general get subpoenas. And if this entire case hangs on the notion that the attorney general's authority to show up and announce and inspect renders the MSA useless, that itself shows how trivial, you know, the government's argument is on the relevance of the MSA. Now, on the question, maybe I'm blowing too much hot air. I'll slow down.
Maybe you're acting in concert with others on that too.
Mr. Carvin made me do it. Just to drive home, you know, the point that Judge Tatel made about footnote 82 of the opinion, where the district court turned to the relevance of the MSA, sentence one, drop footnote where you would put the appropriate legal standard that the judge is using, she used the voluntary cessation standard for mootness. And she said it was incumbent upon the defendants to disprove the possibility of any wrongful conduct, not even a RICO violation, any wrongful conduct in the future. I think I heard the government counsel concede here that if that's what she did, that's legally wrong. And so we start from the proposition that in assessing the impact of the MSA, Judge Kessler conceitedly used the wrong legal standard. More important for our purposes, it is an error that cannot be fixed, because the government never attempted to show that the injunctions that are extant are too narrow, or that in fact they're not enforced, or that they don't cover every possibility of the recurrence of the enterprise. There has never been even an attempt to show on the enterprise front. I understand the government's argument is you're still engaging in conduct we don't like. We don't care that it's not a RICO violation, or even if it's not a mail fraud. You might get somebody who's young to start smoking. And ultimately, you know, the essence of the government's case is we don't like your industry. You do things that we don't like. We caught you at the Plaza Hotel in 1953, and on the basis of that, we're going to build a castle of injunctions that have as a basis nothing other than the executive's distaste for the business of the defendants. And as Mr. Carvin pointed out, you basically put, you know, the First Amendment into a coffin in the bargain. And that's not something that can be fixed on remand. I mean, it is important to emphasize that none of the nitpicks that the government persuaded the district court to accept on the MSA has anything to do with the possibility and much less the likelihood of a future violation of RICO, because at the get-go, for any of the schemes, there is no enterprise. There cannot be a future RICO violation to prevent and restrain. Even if the government thinks that separately the companies are engaged in conduct that they don't like, that will be a future RICO violation. They could have indicted us for mail fraud if they thought they could prove a criminal case. They could have picked any number of other statutes. The one they picked, as I said at the outset, comes with consequences, and those have partly already been seen in the disgorgement opinion. Let me say as well that even taking, you know, the continuing fraud that Judge Tatel also pointed to earlier, that is part of her findings, what ends up being described as fraud by the government and to some extent by the district judge is, you know, the cultural revolution view of how defendants should behave. We say smoking is addictive. We're engaged in a fraud because we do not mouth. It is nicotine that is used in the smoking vehicle to convey the addiction. And if you really look at, you know, the quote-unquote findings, you find a lot of, well, the defendants are still engaged in wrongdoing, because even though in their website they say this is the most recent learning on lights or on ETS, give you a link, you can go read monograph 13, the defendants do not say that they agree with the government. And the continuing fraud in some of these findings, and I urge you to read them, is the government to this day continues to refuse to expressly agree with the government beyond merely stating things that the government disagrees with because they are inconsistent, quote unquote, with the scientific consensus as we have come to know it. And again, that's not a basis for a future injunction. Let me say just a final word on the vagueness of the injunction. I actually think it needs no further word other than the ones that government counsel use. But in case anybody was not closely following what he says, is that the injunction basically is an ad hoc injunction. It means whatever the government or the district judge might think it means later. We'll settle these details in the morning. It's sort of a Scarlett O'Hara injunction. And that is not legally appropriate under this court's cases when network, common cause, and certainly under the Philadelphia Marine case from the government. I see my case is expired.
Your time is up, and although it's late in the proceedings, I am going to take a brief recess and ask the clerk if you can see if you can get that blower toned down, because I'm having difficulty hearing. I don't know whether anyone else is or not, but we'll take a brief recess.
Thank you.
Stand, please.
May it please the court, there actually isn't much to rebut with respect to the cross appeal issues because they weren't addressed in the defendant's own response and rebuttal, but just would like to I'd just like to sort of focus on what I think is just the underlying point, which is that, and I realize that two members of the interlocutory appeal panel are on this panel as well, so I won't presume to suggest to the court what it meant, but we don't understand the court's emphasis on prevent and restrain future violations to sweep quite as broadly as the district court believed that it did. I think that the court there was addressing the issue of disgorgement, that what it said was, and what it said about disgorgement, but obviously as potential implications for other remedies, was also very focused on the particular problems that the court perceived with that remedy. And we don't think that the court was suggesting that the acknowledged rule that a district court is the full panoply of equitable powers in dealing with a case of this kind is abrogated. And so that the remedies that we've raised on our cross appeal, which are...
You would not contend that the language of 1964A gives the full panoply of equitable remedies that exist at, and I realize this contradiction in terms, but exist at common law.
Well, I don't want to sort of retread ground that was covered in our briefs on the interlocutory appeal, but there certainly are decisions talking about how broad that's supposed to be, but I think in this case...
But the statute does speak restrictively of jurisdiction to prevent and restrain violations.
No, that's right, Your Honor, and we don't...
It has to come within that, doesn't it?
That's right, Your Honor.
And the full panoply of equitable remedies might open a box bigger than the one opened by that language.
Reserving our disagreements with the interlocutory decision, yes, that's right. But we do think that the remedies that we've raised on our cross appeal are very much targeted to preventing and restraining future violations.
What about those be specifically? Which ones would those be specifically?
And those are the smoker cessation and education programs.
Well, isn't the cessation program focused on past existing smokers who began smoking in the past?
Yes, the district court, and this goes back to the finding of ongoing conduct.
But there are smokers who became addicted in the past, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so isn't an element of the remedy aimed at them a remedy that looks backwards rather than forwards? In other words, it doesn't restrain future violations. It corrects past violations.
We don't think...
I'm separating the cessation program from the general education program.
Yeah. No, I understand Your Honor's point. We don't think that, at least in this context, if you get someone addicted and you continue to make sales to them and you fundamentally haven't changed your ways, which is what the district court found about the way you're marketing, then a program that essentially keeps you from continuing to make sales based on that addiction, even while you're continuing that ongoing conduct, we don't think is the kind of backward-looking remedy.
The ongoing conduct in question is just selling cigarettes?
No, the district court, again, specifically went through with respect to all the many aspects of the defendant's conduct and made findings.
Well, it's going to be ongoing during the period of time of the proposed cessation remedy that's going to fit within that rubric of ongoing conduct.
That's right, but we think that there can be a cessation remedy. And again, this is look for the district court to tailor. We just think the district court thought...
Not answering my question.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Not answering my question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You said that to continue selling while continuing with that ongoing conduct. And I'm asking you what you mean by ongoing conduct.
Well, it's
proceed during the time of
the... Well, what the district court found is that the defendants are continuing the same kinds of misrepresentations with...
But they're enjoined from doing that.
Well, if they haven't been yet. But assuming... I take Your Honor's point that assuming the efficacy of the remainder of the injunction, that aspect of the relief tends to operate to free people from the addiction. But we still think, and for reasons that Mr. Crystal suggested, that when you've managed to hook people, that it's not that anything that you have to do in the future becomes automatically sort of retroactive. I mean, you can enter into a contract that's found to be sort of a RICO violation, or if a court can order remedies to rescind the contract or even close down a corporation, and the based on in part, dealing with things that happened in the past. And all, our only point is really a fairly modest one, which is that the district court read the prevent and restrain language in light of this court's decision too narrowly, and that the court should at least consider the scope of possible scopes of these remedies that would be consistent with the prevent and restrain, and made a mistake in just taking those off the table at the outset. Finally, with respect to the monitors, we just think also that in implementing aspects of this injunction, that the court may find it appropriate to have a monitor for some purposes, and we just ask the court to clarify that that's not off the
table.
Did
she really hold that there could not be monitors, or did she just hold that the breadth and depth of the monitor you proposed was beyond, was invading the judicial province,
Your Honor,
to an unlawful degree?
If that's what the court, if that's all the court thought, then there, we aren't appealing that, and then there's nothing to correct. It's only to the extent.
I mean, she actually had used a monitor as part of these proceedings at some point, hadn't she? Or, proposed using a monitor, not used.
Yeah. Again, the only relief we would ask for the court, to the extent that the court thinks that a clarification, that the court is operating under a misconception, to clarify it. If the court believes that the court, district court, isn't even operating under that, then that aspect of the relief isn't necessary. Appreciate the time that the court's devoted to this case, and thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Intervene for vote on cross-appeal.
I have two very brief points. Number one, the defendants have not responded to the point that irrespective of future violations, this court's decision in Novartis and Warner stand for the proposition of allowing a program like public education to address the ongoing effects of past misconduct. And that is one of the basis on which we think it's within the district court's equitable authority to order public education. And finally, with regard to the efficacy of an injunctive remedy that Judge Santel, you were just discussing, I just wanted to cite a couple of cases that these are antitrust cases on which RICO is modeled. In the DuPont case and the Shine Theaters case, in DuPont, the court said, quote, the public interest should not be required to depend on the often cumbersome and time-consuming injunctive remedy. And in Shine Theaters, the court said, we start from the premise that an injunction against future violations is not adequate to protect the public interest. As the district court found, the defendants over the years have found many, many ways to avoid injunctive decrees and other efforts to stem their misconduct. And these remedies are necessary here in order to ensure effective remedies to address that conduct both in the future and to address the effects of the conduct in the past. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I believe that's all. Case is submitted. Give us recess.